meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will please come to order. We're here today for the purpose of hearing testimony on House Bill 2060. I had previously asked that anyone who wanted to testify please sign the register, and if someone has come in since that time who desires to testify, I would appreciate having them advise the clerk, and we'll call on them in due course. First, I'd like to hear from Representative Densmore and Senator Roberts jointly. Nelson and the President, as usual, will prevail on this summit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's all right with members of the committee, I'll lead off, and then Senator Roberts will follow. And then if you have any questions of either of us, we'll be happy to answer them.
Fine, whichever order is acceptable to you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've been told that this session is going to be one that will look with skepticism on new ideas and new programs, especially those which cost money. In this case, I hope, though, we can make an exception, for this is not really a new idea, either historically or in the Oregon legislature. It has been introduced regularly during the last decade in the Oregon legislature, and it always seems to meet the same fate, kind of a lingering death in the Ways and Means Committee. Everyone accepts the proposition that it's a good idea. The concern has always been, how do we finance it? Last session, I introduced House Bill 2209, which is virtually the same bill which you have before you today. It's virtually the same bill as Senator Roberts introduced 10 years ago or more in the House, and it's changed, I think, very little in that time. The provisions and funding mechanisms are negotiable. What we're trying to get at is to pass the concept. For it, we think, or I think, has very little opposition and a great deal of support and justification. During the last interim, the Local Government and Transportation Interim Committee, which I was co-chairman of from the House side, was asked by myself and Senator Keith Burns, who was one of the Senate co-chairmen, to reintroduce the bill. By way of general background, I might cite a couple of things from the Interim Committee report, which I assume that the members have had access to or will have access to. I would refer you to pages 20 and 21, where they indicate that this concept is not new. New York has such a program, so does California, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Maryland, and I understand about 13 states in all. The concept originates in some measure with the Code of Hammurabi, which is about 4,000 years ago, that the state, since it's responsible for crime prevention and attention, has some obligation to help those who may be harmed because we haven't done our job properly. House Bill 2060 quickly then provides, one, that compensation shall be paid to victims of crime for injury or death resulting therefrom; two, that such a system shall be administered by the Workmen's Compensation Board, whose procedures we feel are the best to handle this type of legislation and the procedural guarantees that are necessary; three, that procedures for the determination of disability or other extent of injury and the privilege of compensation and maximum amount will be established in due course; and four, that deductible provisions will be enacted so that we're truly helping those people who have very little or no means to get themselves back onto their feet because of such a crime victim situation. During the last interim also, the Western Council of State Governments had a meeting in Portland. Some of you may have had a chance to attend it. There was an address by Mr. Daniel Leach, who was counsel to the Democratic Policy Committee of the United States Senate. And at that time, he gave a speech which he indicated that the federal government is very interested in this particular idea, a bill to provide federal grants and for states that are in such a program and direct federal grants, passed the Senate of the United States last year and died in the House Judiciary Committee because I understand they had some activities going on in the House Judiciary Committee which occupied their time for the balance of the Congress. And I think we all know rather quickly what those were. So I think it was not necessarily that the House Judiciary Committee didn't think it was a good idea, they just didn't have a chance to get at it. So I would be happy to provide a copy of this speech to the members of the committee, which provides more background, if you wish. There is another, besides the possibility of federal assistance for this particular project, I think that we might also, if we want to be creative, do some different transferring of funds, which might make the package a bit more attractive. For example, one might examine the present system of compensating convicts, which is maybe under examination during this session anyway, and earmark part of any increase that one might have to make or would make to go to this fund, which in effect is a transfer of general fund monies, but it may have some impact on the saleability of the idea with the general public. If I might just close by quoting from some of what Mr. Leach has provided. Murder, forcible rape, robbery, assault, a glance at any metropolitan newspaper immediately reveals the extent to which these violent crimes have become an everyday occurrence in our society. Federal, state, and local governments spend millions of dollars on crime prevention and corrections each year, and yet very little of that is directed to the victim. And this bill, I think, addresses itself to that victim. If you want to examine the task force report for the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice, which was concluded even as far back as 1967, they estimated then, and these figures are not subject to the inflationary pressures which we've had, they estimated that the loss of earnings and medical expenses of such victims amounted to $800 million annually and property losses at $4 billion annually, and that was in 1967. I agree it's a national problem, and certainly we can't probably afford to compensate in a total sense every victim of a violent crime in Oregon, but I think that we can at least provide some assistance. I think we have the responsibility to do that.
I would suggest that if it meets with the committee's approval, we hear from Senator Roberts first, and then if you have questions, you can direct to either or both of them. Senator Rank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Representative Dinsmore said this bill has been around for the last decade. It brought me up short because it was exactly 10 years ago that I first introduced the criminal injury compensation proposal into the Oregon State Legislature. And I must admit it was not my original idea. It was a constituent who had studied the New Zealand law and some other foreign countries. And also, as Representative Dinsmore pointed out, a number of states have since, in that 10-year period, adopted the law. I presented it to the legislature in 1965, hoping that Oregon would be the first state in the nation to take this step that I thought was a very humanitarian one and needed. But in 1965, my bill had not included the Workman's Compensation Board as the agency that would handle these kinds of claims. And consequently, the bill went to Ways and Means, and there was a great deal of concern that it was the creation of a new commission, and so it died in Ways and Means. 1967, I reintroduced the bill and did include the concept of the Workman's Compensation Board administration, and it again went to Ways and Means and died there. So it obviously was not going to fly because of the concerns for how much money would be required to support the program. Although I must say that in 1967, the Workman's Comp people did come in and supported the concept and was willing to take on the responsibilities. The legislature gave them that responsibility, but with, of course, some additional personnel that would be required. And I'm sure you're going to hear from Mr. Wilson, who probably will say very much the same thing. I guess I want to thank Al for inviting me over to testify, because I did have to go through my old file, which we have four files on criminal injury. If any of you want to do any research, I'll be happy to open them up to you. But I found the old 1967 bill that I had introduced, and I've been worried for some time that it's very difficult for me to read our current bills because of the size of the print, and I thought it was my eyes. But if you'll notice, since 1967, the print has become smaller, and it's really not my eyes at all. Al, thanks a lot.
That's very encouraging, isn't it?
Yes, that makes my day. I want to reiterate one or two comments that Al has touched upon, and it deals with really the philosophy back of this bill. First one is the original obligation of government, of course, was to protect those people who might band together for safety reasons, and consequently we still consider that to be a primary function of government, is to provide for the safety and welfare of its individuals. If in fact the government is not able to do that, then it would follow that the government has an obligation to compensate those persons for whom they have been unable to protect. And I was very proud in 1965, I believe it was, and then following in the second year, to have Dean Seward Reese from Willamette Law School appear as a major witness to support this idea. He had done a great deal of research on it, had written articles on it, was attempting to get Oregon to adopt such legislation. And Dean Reese was a real scholar in the area and was able to give the committee a great deal of background on that. I also had George Van Humison, who was then the district attorney in Multnomah County, and Don Clark, who was then the sheriff in Multnomah County, as I recall, both testified. And those two people suggested that there might even be justification for local contributions to the payment of this compensation, since local government has generally, with the exception of the state police, the obligation for law enforcement and for the prosecution of crime. And so both of those people, who were then elected law enforcement officials, supported the idea and even went so far as to say that local government might share in this obligation, because it might be a defect in their own police protection for those individuals. I'd like to go a little bit further on the philosophy behind the bill. We're looking at individuals who, through no fault of their own, are victims of a crime and are taxpayers, we assume, and surely they are. And besides the inconvenience, the injury, and the cost to those persons who are the victims, they then find themselves in the position of paying taxes to support in a penal institution the person who inflicted the crime upon them. Consequently, we find them a victim of the crime itself, and then we find them a victim of taking care of rehabilitation of the person that committed the crime. And so, in a sense, we are saying to these individuals, while you're paying taxes to take care of the individual in the institution and to try to bring about a reform of that individual, but also paying for that person's care during that period, this person is also trying to recuperate from the injury that was inflicted upon him or upon her. I would hasten to have you take note that there is no requirement for compensation for property damage. in this, but only for personal injury. And I think in my bill it was deliberate, and I'm sure that in Al's bill it is deliberate, because one step at a time, I suppose, is the philosophy. We're really trying to get at those persons who are unable to earn an income as a result of the crime, or who have the expense of medical expenses, and who perhaps loss of wages, as well as, in cases of death, maybe the loss of the wage earner himself in the family. And I think that it would be really going a little too far to compensate people who lose property, and would certainly complicate the bill. I assume this bill, Mr. Chairman, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
I was going to ask Mr. Blair. I assumed it would have.
Then if the committee does look with favor upon the bill, I would encourage, hopefully, a speedy analysis of the bill and some determination of what, if you are favorable to the bill, to get it to Ways and Means at an early time, so that those persons who would be considering it in Ways and Means would have a full opportunity, and not wait until the last few weeks when they say the money's all gone, and therefore, bring it back again next session. I do believe that there is some possibility of recovering some of this money from those who do commit a crime, and this has been discussed at some length by individuals in terms of restitution to the individual. But I think that Al's idea is far better, because it means restitution to the fund, and it removes then that personal responsibility between the victim and the person who committed the crime. As a rule, the victim wants nothing more to do with the person who committed the crime, and in many cases wants to forget the incident, and consequently to require restitution to the fund rather than to the individual is, I think, a good choice. I discovered in going through my bill, Al, one proposed amendment that I might call to your attention in closing, in the event you are considering the proposal, and it's under the payment of medical expenses on page 4, section 7, subsection 1. Where it says that the subject to deduction, and this would also, I think, wherever necessary in the bill, and I did not go through it thoroughly, would mean that there might also be other payments. But after the word medical in subsection 1 should be added, or any other remedial care recognized under state law. And this might save you some problems of other care that we have recognized as compensatory under workman's compensation, for example, that might not necessarily be included in medical, and I'm not sure whether chiropractic treatment is included as medical, and I think that this is what that is intended to get at, that that perhaps you might want to include that language. But other than that, Mr. Chairman, I have no further comments.
All right, thank you, Senator. Questions of Representative Dinsmore or Senator Roberts? Mr. Dunn?
I have a question on section 16 concerning possible compensation by the perpetrator of the crime. It seems to me, and I'd like your opinion on this, but it seems to me there might be some advantage to limiting the board's ability to assess penalties, so that if a person is on work release or some program where they have an incentive to get out and work and make some money, that every penny of that money wouldn't be taken. So you say perhaps that there could be an assessment up to 75% or 50% of no more than 50% of the funds earned while in prison could be taken for this purpose, so that there would be an incentive to that person in prison to continue in that program. And I wonder if I might have your comments on that.
I would have no objection to that. I think that's probably a reasonable idea.
I think perhaps if you want to be more specific, you might. But if you look on line 6, it says that 5 and 6, that there would be reimbursement to the board for the whole or any specified part of the amount of compensation paid or payable, together with the whole or any specified part of any cost. And so that, I guess, means that the board can make a determination of what amount would be paid.
I realize that may give them protection. It just seemed to me if you limited the board so they were clear,
mm-hmm.
that they could wipe out that entire
right.
effort with that principle.
I think that's a good idea.
Other questions?
David? This is just a minor one. Section 22, very last line on the last page, is best if the misprint should be compensable offenses. That's a pertinent. Another more substantive question is in the design of this bill, is the decision of the compensation board appealable to any of the courts with reference to the amount of compensation or whether the injury should be compensated?
With respect to the other point which Representative Bunn was addressing, any order under that situation, I note in Section 16 is still, I would assume, I'm no lawyer, but is appealable to the circuit court, and I'd have to reread the bill and know a little bit more about law than I do to answer that question, but I think that would be our intent.
Under subsection 5, on page 8 under subsection 5, where any order is made under this section, the sender may appeal the order to the Supreme Court in the same manner as if it were a judgment or decree.
Well, that deals with the amount assessed against the offender. I'm
right.
concerned, though, about the victim. If the victim is denied compensation or is not given an amount of compensation that the victim deems to be adequate, is that order of the
I don't
board
believe that's
appealable?
Right.
Well, Section 15 is Section 16, and notwithstanding the other provision, an appeal shall not lie against any determination of the board.
Right, all right. That answers my question.
And then 16 deals with appeals. Yeah, it looks like it's appeals relating to the order directing the offender to reimburse. That's the indirection of that.
Yes, Dad. Now, how many, or I'll ask the Senator Brown, either one, how many states have enacted 13, as I understand it? Is there any pattern on the funding of these programs in other states? Have they gone through the workman's compensation type of procedure? Do they have other funding alternatives?
California, as I recall, Alan, you spend a night to spend some time since I've done really recent research on it, created a commission, separate commission. But it functioned rather loosely, up at least in about 1967, and I haven't followed it since then.
You don't know whether it was supported by general fund or...
They've tied it close
fund.
To the welfare program
mm-hmm.
in California.
Mm-hmm.
And New York has done specifically what Betty's alluded to, and that's create another separate crime victims compensation board. Most states, I think, I'd have to redo the research, but I think have tried to stay with existing agencies wherever possible, though sometimes for visibility and other reasons, I suppose, want to create a separate one. That research is, I'm sure, available.
I'm not sure that Mr. Wilson would agree with me on this when he testifies to the Workman's Comp Board, but as we all know, the Workman's Compensation Board is in the business of determining compensation for injuries. And it seems very logical that their method of determination and their expertise in this area could very easily be transferred to the determination of what should be a just compensation for an injury that a person sustains as a result of a criminal attack. Without going through a whole new commission that would have to almost do the same thing in evaluating that injury as the workman's comp.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just
I did a little quick research, and it seems that in all states except Massachusetts, claims for victim compensation are handled by administrative agencies. Each of these states created a special commission or board to supervise the programs except for Washington and California. So I stand corrected. In two cases, they handled it with existing agencies, and the rest of them created special ones.
One of the other questions I had was that, is the definition section here broad enough to include a citizen who would try to prevent the occurrence of a crime, to have him compensated?
You're talking about Good Samaritan law?
Yes.
Yeah. If that person is injured as a result of a commission of a crime, then I would think that it would. If that person is injured in trying to prevent a crime, does in fact have a crime committed upon him if he is injured by the person in any way.
It would be a criminal act, certainly. Let's see where Hardy, did you have a question?
Just a couple. In Washington, California, use the workers' compensation board or their equivalent of the law.
Not according to this. It says they had.
No, those were the ones that had existing agencies, but I don't know.
They were unidentified.
Yeah. The pending federal proposal, is that for grants to states for this purpose? It's not a compensation system on the federal level.
I think it involves elements of both. I'd have to reread with more care, and I apologize in advance, I guess, for not completely prepared to talk about all of the things I wanted to talk about, because the hearing caught me up pretty short. But
this committee is going to move right along.
I'm happy about that, Mr. Chairman, but I keeping in mind I might be in error on that point, and we'll try to get the information for you as rapidly as possible. I think they had some elements of both, owing to the fact that there are, I'm sure, federal crimes that they would be concerned about. The specific list of crimes they defined on page 22, and I'll get a copy of this speech for you. There were 18 specific ones that they tried to deal with, and I assume that some of them, like kidnapping, is specifically a federal crime, I would think, isn't it? So a federal crime, so they would have to have some kind of a mechanism to handle that at a federal level by themselves, I suppose. And the other crimes would seem to me logical, though the Congress of the United States is not always logical, to allow states to handle the system otherwise. So I'll get this copy of this to you and that kind of research.
If I might ask you, I don't know if any of the research to date has broken down the other states' acts in sort of analytical form to give a side-by-side comparison of how they handle certain, you know, how they administer each state method, how, you know, what crimes compensable, benefit levels.
I don't know if there was any
research. Hardy, Catherine Buffet has had a running interest in this ever since we worked on it originally, and she quite regularly just runs across material and sends it on to me, knowing of my interest. And I think probably that she may have in her own files enough of that information to get it, so that if you want to break out the chart of what each state does in each area, it probably wouldn't be too difficult to get.
I don't want anybody to have a lot of trouble for this, but we're regulating in some way that I think it might be.
We do have the materials that Julie News brought down to the committee, the materials that were developed during the interim by the interim committee, and we may have some of that in those files. I haven't had a chance to examine all of them yet, but they did have a great amount of material, including, I think, perhaps copies of the speech that represented them. Do we at least, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Do we at least have some information about the total costs and the participation and the number of applications filed and programs similar to this in the United States?
Yeah. that information is available.
I noticed under one section there was a provision that said that if somebody received benefits under another section of law, in other words, let's say they're involved in some sort of criminal case where there's some civil liability, and they sue on the basis of the other person's civil liability, and they receive enough to pay all their injuries, they would still receive something under the act?
No.
Not correct.
Any compensation would be deducted. Any,
it's offset.
It's offset in payment.
Other
I
question?
Mean, from most any other
if not, Al, as the sponsor, or part of the sponsor at least of this bill, do you have any objection to the amendment proposed by Senator Roberts in
None.
Section 7?
None.
On Section 7, line 31, subsection 1, after the word medical, the following language would be inserted. In any other remedial care, I guess it's or any other remedial care recognized under state law. Is that correct?
That's right.
Is there any objection to that amendment? It's adopted by unanimous consent.
Mr. Chairman, one more thing on my item 2 of instant research. The federal bill does propose a 90% federal subsidy for state compensation programs, was part of the Senate proposal.
John?
I might ask Representative Dansmore, this is really a question I suppose on legislative intent. Section 1, when you read the definition under sub 4, compensable offense, along with the definition of injury in sub 6, and the way I read it is obviously under 6, intended to include mental or nervous shock. If the intent was there to, before you would allow recovery for that it would have to be associated with some physical injury to the person. In other words, when we're talking about crimes of violence, the definition of compensable offense would include any felony that might not necessarily be a violent felony if you were going to authorize recovery for mental suffering or shock. If that's going to come under the definition of injury. See what I mean? Does the bill contemplate that you could recover just for mental suffering
without
in the absence of physical injury to the body?
I wouldn't think so. Was that your intent?
Don, I think probably that there's that if that is all that there is to be compensated for, that there would be little compensation available to that person, because the person would have to show actual loss and medical payment for nervous shock and that sort of thing. And you'll notice there is a $25 deductible somewhere in the bill that the board isn't constantly burdened with just small amounts of claims, and that deduction might even be raised so that the small amounts that a person suffers would not be a claim.
Did you have a question, Reverend?
Yes, with respect to that same point. Suppose that a person is present in a bank and there's a bank robbery, and that person dies of a heart attack while witnessing the robbery.
That would be a major.
Is that a compensable offense in?
I would under this or nervous shock. I would think so. If you can tie it directly to the crime, but the question is, was a crime committed upon this individual? He suffered a heart attack. So there has to be the crime against the individual before it's compensated.
Well, I'm thinking really of the bystander problem, which is always a problem in tort law, as you know, that the witness to a crime, witness, for example, to an assault on a street, the assault is not directed against the person, but the witness suffers severe nervous shock or a heart attack, which is not an uncommon occurrence. My question, really, maybe as a matter of making legislative history here, is whether or not, in the view of the sponsors of this bill, that would be a desirable way to extend the act or whether that would create more problems than
I think
you'd like
it,
to see.
It, my personal opinion is it would create more problems because in other sections here, it provides that there has that there does not have to be a conviction in order for there to be a compensation. Because sometimes the police, we know a crime was committed, but sometimes the police don't find the person that committed the crime. And yet we know that the injury was sustained, and consequently that person should be compensated regardless of whether or not there is conviction. And so I think if you're, I think we're trying to get at where there is the direct relationship between the crime and the victim. The word proximate cause is used here, and I suppose if you could establish proximate cause in the kind of situation that you suggested, that person would be eligible. And whether or not there would be an actual charge made against the person who robbed the bank for the death of the individual who suffered the heart attack would be entirely up to the police to make that charge. And I don't know whether they do in those kinds of cases or not. But there might be a compensation whether or not there was in fact a conviction.
Other questions? That way, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Frommeyer, you want to testify? You may testify, right? So you did. But you have some comments to make.
Maybe I'll look for a
semen or
I want to add my strong support to the committee's consideration of a bill providing for compensation of victims of violent crime. I regard this currently as a major omission in our system of criminal justice. If the victim is the last person with whom we as a society have concerned ourselves, and I think that any humane system of criminal justice ought to attend to the needs of the victim as well as to the problems of the offender and his or her rehabilitation. This is a matter that has concerned me for some time, as our testimony has already indicated, and I will not review. Procedures for compensation for victims of violent crime go back to 2500 BC. Systems are well in effect in Great Britain and New Zealand. This is not a new scheme. It's not an untried scheme. It is one which other societies, which are progressive, have long since adopted. The state of Washington, our neighbor to the north, adopted such a bill in 1974. And for those of the committee who wish to review it, there's an excellent piece in the Washington Law Review just this year describing in detail the system which our neighboring state has put into effect. I don't think that it's necessary to go on endlessly about the kinds of problems that victims of violent crime suffer, but one thing which is commonly noted is that, for example, in the crime of rape, not only does the victim have her own medical expenses to take care of, but I think it's established by reliable evidence that it's quite typical for rape victims, for example, some 8 or 9 months after the event, to go into severe depression or at least have psychological problems associated with a very traumatic event. And as I say, there is no system in our society that now provides for redress of those kinds of injuries. I think as a matter of dealing with the details of this legislation, we as a committee have a number of different issues which we will have to confront. I understand that several other different models of crime compensation bills will be introduced, and I strongly recommend that we advance them on our calendar or at least
hold in abeyance further consideration of this bill until we can set them side by side.
That's the plan, Representative from
yes,
is to hold this bill until such time we have an opportunity to look at other proposals and then make a determination of what, if anything, we want to do.
Right. I think, too, that we would be well advised to have close access to the legislation that's currently in the United States Congress in both Senate and House committees there, because this may well deal with the adequacy of any proposed Oregon law to receive federal funding. And I would hope that our committee legislative assistant would be able to secure that for us. I think one major issue will be the agency which would be best entrusted to administer this program. And there is, in fact, a variety, as Representative Kulongowski's question elicited. For example, in the state of Massachusetts, the compensation scheme is handled by the district courts. In the state of Washington, it's handled by the Commission on Labor and Industries, which is essentially the Washington model of workers' compensation. In California, it's handled by the Department of Social Welfare, which creates, of course, the identification of the program with a poverty or a welfare program, and that may be, for many reasons, a highly undesirable identification to have for a program of this nature. In the state of New York, there is a separate Crime Victims Compensation Board, which is established as an independent state agency. I think we're well aware of the cost considerations which may dictate which way a program like this should be directed. I think that there is an advantage in establishing it in an existing agency, since that would lower the startup costs for at least the initial operation. But it also might lead to a diffusion in the public's mind of the real importance of this. And I think that's a consideration we'll want to weigh carefully. Also, if it's established within the Workmen's Compensation Board, it strikes me that it may be somewhat anomalous to have that board with a very careful schedule of injuries and compensation for industrial-type injuries, and then to have the more flexible manner of awarding compensation as it's set out in this bill. And I think we might wish to see those coordinated more carefully. The third major area that I think we should look at with care is its coverage. The bill does not appear to be limited to Oregon residents, and I think we might want to decide whether or not that's desirable. It's not apparently limited by any income level, as some states have done in an effort to control the cost of the program. This bill limits compensation to victims of felonies, and yet I think that it might be unfortunate if we left compensation to the vagaries of the pleading and plea bargaining process. I'm sure many of us can think of misdemeanor manslaughter type offenses, which would be technically or possibly at least excluded from coverage, which ought to be. My suggestion in this regard then is that I think we should make at least some effort to look at states which have spelled out the types of crimes to which compensation is offered. I think that that might be more likely to give us a cost handle on the problem as well. I see that the proposed bill has added a fixed amount which would act as a ceiling. And I think that from a fiscal standpoint, that probably is a realistic and necessary measure to secure its passage. I think the bill is unclear as to the treatment, for example, of pain and suffering, or what we in tort law know as pain and suffering. And I'm not sure but what we shouldn't look very carefully at the mental or emotional shock standard that has just been discussed to see if that can't be clarified further. Finally, I think that with respect to the technical administration of the bill, I think that we should look very carefully about how payments are made and whether or not it might be better to have periodic payments with a periodic review as to the health status of the individual rather than giving lump sum type awards, which might, as the recovery progresses, either turn out to be too small or too large. Those are, as I say, Mr. Chairman, some technical details that I think will go to the workability of the bill. But insofar as its concept is concerned, I do hope that the committee gives it every favorable consideration and passes it out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks. Good questions. The representative from very clear. No one wants to ask anything. Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I don't have the long acquaintanceship with the subject that some of the other speakers have told you about this morning.
Excuse me, Dan, for the record, will you identify yourself?
Yes, I'm an attorney. I practice law in private practice in Portland. There are really, what it boils down to, in connection with this
bill, as far as I'm concerned, if you were to put me on the spot and said, do you want the bill the way it is or no bill at all, I would say yes, pass the bill the way it is. Because I think that just in terms of sheer and raw equity, that society owes many of these people something, and they traditionally have gotten nothing. Talking about a couple of the serious problems that I see in the bill, just from the standpoint of whether it will deliver what it advertises, I noticed that Representative Frohnmayer raised the question of whether there was any system of judicial review of the board's decision-making process in the bill. And the bill, I think, in Section 15 is quite clear that there is not. I find that anomalous, to say the least, because if you turn the page to page 16, you find that the offender, when there's an order entered against him, does have the right of appeal to the Supreme Court. I think this is a bad situation. I have had largely my practice involves workman's compensation law and procedure. I have done a great deal of study on it. And there was an article that was written by Dean Arthur Larson about 10 years ago that I think deals with this precise problem in a workman's compensation setting. He did a study of the English compensation system, comparing a time when there was no appeal from the compensation administrator's decision to the courts to other times when there was the right of an appeal from the compensation administrator's decision to the courts. The title of his article is The Myth of Administrative Generosity, a lesson from British experience. The conclusion that Dean Larson came to from that study is that in most cases, the decisions of the English Commissioner of Insurance have been insistent upon technicalities, however harsh, the resulting forfeitures, the rule that ignorance of the law is no excuse is uncompromisingly applied, and even ignorance of the seriousness of the illness has been rejected as a reason for failure to make timely claims. His conclusion is that it's a serious mistake to construct any kind of a compensation system without some recourse to the court of the administrator's decision. And I would endorse that idea. And I would certainly recommend to you that you look carefully at Section 15 and maybe Section 16 in that regard in the present bill. Secondly, I have serious questions about whether the Workmen's Compensation Board is the right vehicle to handle these claims. I am very familiar with the procedures and the practices of the Workmen's Compensation Board. First of all, what you have here is not a bill that requires decision only. This bill requires the administrator to investigate the claims, to take applications, to make payments, the whole ball of wax. And that is not what the Workmen's Compensation Board is presently doing, or not what the Workmen's Compensation Board is presently set up to do. But even more seriously, it seems to me, you have some other problems. One, the Workmen's Compensation Board is located in Salem, and while they do have hearings referees that go around the state to hold hearings in various outlying communities, they do not have representatives in the outlying communities to, for instance, accept claims against the fund which you're creating by this bill. Now, and this leads me into another problem area with the bill. What they found in other states, apparently, is that, and what everybody worries about when they pass a bill of this kind, is you're going to have a big flood of claims, and you're going to have a big, large expense and a large draw on the public treasury. That has not been the case, apparently, in the other states that have passed laws of this kind. I'm reading from an article that I think was published probably in 1971 in the, what's a law journal, some type. But New York had an extensive program of going out and publicizing the availability of funds under this program for victims of violent crime. They went on radio and television and got out brochures and advertised and everything. And out of approximately 45,000 criminal offenses that had potentially eligible victims for compensation, they had 1,594 applications for compensation. Many of the states, I think I read in the same article, and I'll leave this with you, many states that have substantially greater populations than we have here in Oregon that have passed these programs get very limited amounts of claims. But anyhow, the board has no facilities statewide for accepting and processing these claims for citizens on a local level. And so the people are either going to have to deal by mail or come to Salem in person, or they're going to just forget about the entire thing and they're not going to get what they have coming to them. In this connection, this article, which is the best that I've ever run across on the subject, and it was published in about 71 or 72, kind of collates the entire subject, or collects the entire subject in one document. And basically there are four ways that these claims have been handled worldwide. Other countries have also adopted programs of this type. The two ways that we've talked most about here today are the put the program into an existing administrative agency, such as the Workmen's Compensation Board. The second way is to put it into a specialized agency, which apparently a number of the other states have done. In other words, create a special agency just to handle these claims. Now, as I say, both of those methods of implementing the bill have the same problem. You either have to put an agency in each county or each region of the state, or you run the risk that the people who are entitled to the benefits either won't find out about it or won't take advantage of it or can't take advantage of it. The other two ways that they have handled these, and I think these are primarily in New Zealand and New South Wales or Australia, is that they have either made the compensation of the victim kind of a pendant part of the criminal prosecution in the criminal court. In other words, if you go through and you prosecute the criminal, as part of the same case, the judge has heard the evidence, the victim presumably was in court if there was a trial, knows something about the case, and he then enters the order awarding the compensation as part of a kind of a tail end of the criminal case. Now, that has some problems, obviously, because not all cases go to trial, and not all cases are prosecuted. But I think it has the makings of a reasonable system in a state like Oregon, where in almost every county we have circuit court judges, or at least every two or three counties in the more sparsely populated areas. The other method, and Representative Frohnmeyer mentioned this in his statement, the other method is just straight civil suit, like in Massachusetts, by the victim to obtain the compensation. And this would be, I guess, in Oregon, either in the circuit or the district court. So those are the four ways that have been used so far. I'm worried about loading this job on top of the Workmen's Compensation Board's already rather burdensome job. I think they have more now to do than they can expeditiously do. As you may or may not know, they not only handle the appeal system for the workmen's compensation claims, but they also have substantial rehabilitation duties supervising rehabilitation of injured workmen. and they have substantial duties with regard to safety enforcement of the state safety laws. So they're an extremely busy group of people already. They are not really in the business that's covered by this bill, and I think it would be it would cause them problems, and I don't think that it would deliver the benefits to the people that are entitled to them as efficiently as we might hope. I would like to leave both of these articles here with you because I think they both have a bearing on the two major problems that I see in your bill. There are, I think, some minor problems in the bill. When I think of all of the money that is spent in the criminal justice system now on the offender, I can't rationalize that when I read the amount of benefits that you want to give to the victim of the criminal offender's offense. I know that you gentlemen have to vote on these things, and the appropriation of public funds is always a serious matter, but the benefits really are not totally equitable. They're quite skimp. I question the language that you should deduct from all of the benefits, from whatever benefits that you might find a claimant entitled to under this bill, all of the things that you say you're going to deduct in Section 8. I think it might be better if you would say that you can take into account his income and benefits from other sources, because I think you might get into cases where somebody could be entitled to some money under this compensation fund, even though they're getting the payments that they're getting under the other subsections of Section 8. With respect to Section 5, where you talk about the victim did not provoke or aid in the commission of the offense, in civil cases in the state of Oregon, we've adopted the doctrine of comparative negligence, and I see no reason why a similar doctrine shouldn't be applied in this situation. In other words, you should obviously not be paying people that are totally at fault for what happened to them, but I think there's degrees of fault in this and other matters. Those are the major objections that I have to the bill. I do strongly endorse the concept of the bill, and I think it's one that's been coming for a long time, and its time is overdue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. Questions?
I do have that federal bill, by the way, if somebody wants to.
Mr. Kulongoski.
Dan, in your review of the other states, how many of them actually compensate only for medical injury loss, and how many of them have a property compensation?
If I said that I reviewed the other states, I misled you. The only thing I reviewed for my testimony today was this article, which doesn't go into that in detail. I have reviewed that in the past, and the other states are all over the ballpark. Most of the bills are written in very tight, restrictive language. And the federal bill is too, as I recall. Although the limits of benefits are much higher under the federal bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Got it.
Dan, under this administrative approach, in terms of administration, of making the compensation a part of criminal proceeding, if there is one, how is that handled when there is no criminal proceeding? It's still handled as a hearing before a judge?
It's always handled as a hearing before the judge. There's no jury trial. It's after the end of the criminal proceeding, as I understand it. The only thing I really know about it is what's in this article. If there was no prosecution, I suppose that it would still come before the judge, but it would be as a part of the criminal justice process. In other words, the district attorney, I suppose, could have a responsibility for processing these matters or taking the application. reason and thing to it that they came before a judge for adjudication.
And then the fourth version, perhaps they had alluded to, but I missed it, a straight civil action.
Yes.
Are you speaking of the present system?
Right. I mean, like...
I thought you were talking about some variety of criminal compensation other than the one we know. Or of victim compensation.
No, no,
but
I am.
You're alluding to the present.
No, I am. I mean a petition of some type in one of the courts, district or circuit court, to obtain compensation out of this fund.
I...
Right. Not an action against the wrong. The offender.
And under that variety, how is the petition adjudicated?
By a circuit court or a judge.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's referred to the attorney general or the district attorney to investigate and present the evidence in behalf of the fund.
Let me ask another question that relates to your experience as a working compensation petitioner. You mentioned some administrative considerations that, in your view, would work against the selection of the Workers' Compensation Board as the administrative agency. Is that general approach to taking an agency? Now, do you have any sense, feeling about the effect on the administration of the Act in terms of actual decision making, if the board, given its present kinds of decisions, are also having an open ended kind of very subjective judgment of whether you have one?
No, I, if you know, if I represented a claimant under this system of compensation, or maybe even if I was a claimant, I would be pretty satisfied with having a hearing before one of the Workman's Compensation Board hearing referees. I think what I was talking about was the fact that this bill does not allow judicial review of those decisions, and that's where I think a serious problem comes in.
I recognize that, and I think
whether it's the present board or any other board.
But your principal concern with respect to the Workman's Compensation Board is the scope and weight of its present responsibility.
Yes, and the fact that they're not out in the community,
yeah,
where the people are that are victims of crime, like circuit judges or district judges.
Representative Marks.
The third way you mentioned, using the criminal court and apparently having the, well, you have the DA file a statement saying how much this victim.
As I would see this House Bill 2060, it's always going to be initiated by somebody making an application for funds out of the fund. Now, where they would make that application, whether it be with the Workman's Compensation Board or a special agency or with the clerk of the circuit court, I don't know. But once they make the application in the circuit court relating to your question, then I would see it as the obligation of the district attorney, who has most of the information anyhow, and if he doesn't, he can get it from the police, to see to it that the facts are brought into court at the appropriate time.
And in that connection, do you see any conflict between a district attorney who prosecutes the offender to begin with and then represents the fund in the second instance?
No. As a matter of fact, I think it goes on all the time, Mr. Chairman, where you have people who represent the Workman's Compensation Board who are from time to time suing individuals who haven't made the correct amount of contributions to get money back into their fund, who represent the State Accident Insurance Fund in subrogated claims against third parties and other people. I don't see a conflict there.
Is it, Mr. Chairman, is there some systems that exist now that have it integrated with the court? That is, they charge the defendant who's convicted a certain amount of money for reimbursing the victim.
That can be done. I think sometimes as a condition of probation. The court will say to the offender, you pay back the money you stole from Representative Hart. You know, that is done to some extent now.
Yes, Hardy.
In Washington, I understand they have assimilated the system to their workman's compensation statute.
I was not aware of that. That's what I heard, though, today.
So you don't know how they're having a problem of geographical access to this?
No, I don't. The difference, you see, I do not, in answer to your question. The difference that I see is this. In the workman's compensation system, you always have someone who has a relationship with the state fund on the scene. That's the employer. He's paying a premium, and he wants this thing taken care of, and he'll see to it that the papers are sent to the Department of Labor and Industry in Washington. In this compensation scheme here, there is just no connection between the people who might be entitled to benefits and the people who are in charge of seeing whether they are in fact entitled to them and getting their application filed and getting it processed. It's a difficult thing. Doesn't probably sound too difficult sometimes, but for people who don't know how it's to be done, it can be overwhelming.
Other questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan.
Dick Feeney.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Feeney. I represent the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. Yesterday afternoon, all five members of our board met for the first time, and sometimes, as a matter of fact, and by unanimous vote approved the concept and general direction of this legislation and asked me to present to you today testimony that had been prepared by Commissioner Mel Gordon, who would have appeared here today but was detained by Commission business. The first three pages of Commissioner Gordon's prepared testimony, he outlines the efforts that Multnomah County is making to rehabilitate the offenders. So I will begin on page 3, where he turns his attention to an area of neglect, victims for crime. If we are inclined to accept the statistical summaries, it would appear that violent crimes increased more than 150% during the decade of the 1960s. Looking at the reverse side of the coin, we can conclude that the number of innocent victims who suffered physically or died as a result of criminal activity also increased significantly during that same decade. In hearings conducted late last year by the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary, Representative Joshua Eilberg of Pennsylvania summarized as follows. Our American system of jurisprudence allows recourse for a victim of crime only if he can, 1, locate the offender, 2, sue in civil court for damages, and 3, collect after a successful judgment is rendered. The President's Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence noted, however, that only 1.8% of all victims of crime ever collect anything for the injuries or personal losses they suffer. Multnomah County is already taking some steps to demonstrate greater concern for victims of crime. The county is now participating in a new program which will provide 24-hour assistance to rape victims. This service includes counseling services, funds for medical and mental health services, and funds for public education materials. The county has also recently completed a grant application requesting federal funds, which would enable justice officials to notify victims about the outcome of their cases, instruct victims about the processes of the criminal justice system, and refer victims to governmental and private agencies which can assist them with their problems. Also, to help victims recover property lost as a result of criminal acts, and to ensure that victims are not abused during the process of investigation and prosecution. Many arguments can be made to support the importance of statewide legislation in this area. We think there are three arguments which rank importantly among these elements. One is precedent. It's part of our tradition to provide for the welfare and security of all citizens. When we think about the importance of Social Security, workman's compensation, old age assistance programs, aid to the blind, Medicare, veterans assistance, and other programs, we begin to wonder why it has taken so long to recognize and compensate victims of criminal acts. When we consider this vast range of legislation, it becomes apparent that law-abiding citizens who become innocent victims deserve more attention from their government than they have received. If we can spend large sums on offenders, we're certainly capable of providing at least a modest program of compensation for victims. Incident. We cannot ignore the question, who are the victims of crime? It is clear that the victims come from all social classes and all neighborhoods. Certain individuals are more vulnerable than others. The 1965 survey estimated that 91% of the victims of violent crime earned less than $6,000 per year. Further, less than half the population under 65 years have hospitalization insurance coverage. There is not much reason to believe that these facts have changed dramatically since 1965. A disproportionately large number of the victims of violent crime are apparently poor, members of minority groups, poorly educated, and marginally employed. Compensation for victims of crime is a priority need of these citizens. Third important element is experience. Our research in the county indicates 12 states have already initiated programs to compensate the victims of violent crime, and other states are considering such legislation. The national legislation, which has been referred to here today, has also been proposed and would make federal grants available to help underwrite state programs. We believe there is much we can learn from other states which have successfully enacted this legislation. The board's action yesterday, they did not go through HB 2060 line by line, but rather endorsed the key elements which they thought should be important for whatever legislation the committee eventually recommends. One, that the legislation would provide opportunity for restitution by the offender. Whenever possible, the offender should be required to provide some level of monetary restitution when his acts involve injury or death to innocent victims. There should be strong encouragement to judges and courts to consider some form of restitution either at the time of sentencing or as a condition of parole. Second, offenders should be liable for restitution for as many as 7 years following the commission of a crime. There was discussion on that at the board meeting yesterday, and the board suggested that there be a 7-year statute of limitations on liability of offenders to pay restitution. Third, those eligible for benefits should include not only victims but their dependent survivors as well. It is imperative that innocent victims who sustain injury in attempting to prevent a criminal act or apprehend an apparent offender also be entitled to compensation. Fourth, we support the concept that victims' compensation legislation be drawn on the strength of existing agencies with established rules and procedures. We feel, therefore, that a victims' compensation program in Oregon could probably best be administered by the Workmen's Compensation Board. The role of the board is well understood by Oregonians, and many rules and procedures which are applicable in employment situations will also be applicable in a program which compensates victims for injury, loss of income, and so forth. Fifth, in addition to compensation for injury or death, serious thought should be given to benefits which would make physical and occupational therapy and rehabilitation available to victims of crime. Sixth, recognizing that many victims of crime face difficult circumstances, the compensation board should be authorized to make funds available to victims on an emergency basis prior to final action by the board where real need exists. And finally, we think it appropriate to consider special compensation provisions for police and firemen and other carefully identified public safety personnel when they become the victims of criminal activity. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dave. Questions, Mr. Feeney? Okay.
I'm representing from my
Go ahead.
On page 6 of the testimony, you referred to a 1965 survey that 91% of the victims of violent crime earned less than $6,000 a year. Do you know the source of that survey, or do you have an updated survey with respect to the characteristics of crime?
No, I don't have an updated one, and I understand it's a federal source, but I don't know which one.
So this would be nationwide then, rather than Oregon?
This is nationwide, not Oregon, my understanding. Another question.
What does the meaning of the last comment there on special compensation provision? Does that mean something in addition to? Have you had a chance to look at this bill yet?
I've looked the bill over, but I'm unaware of whether it contains that provision. I know that the concern the board had goes back to some discussions in the past about compensation for firemen and policemen for their widows. And it's because of this long-standing policy, I think we wanted that included. Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Dave. Mr. Wilson?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Keith Wilson, Chairman of the Workers' Compensation Board of Oregon. I'm not prepared to discuss with you or testify in detail about the contents of bills, House Bill 2060. However, in past sessions, the board has appeared and testified in identical or similar legislation, and has taken the position that we as people of the community and citizens of the state of Oregon, and certainly having humanitarian interest as we all have, that we heartily commend to you the philosophy and the rationale of a proposal such as this. And this has been the position of the board since I've been on it, and as I understand, for several sessions prior to that time. Representative Krohmeyer and Attorney Dan O'Leary have pretty much said everything that I was prepared to say about some of the considerations that should be given to this proposal. In essence, I commend to you the thought that you should very seriously consider tying the administration of this type of program into the court system of the state rather than the Workman's Compensation Board for many of the same reasons that were expressed by Mr. O'Leary. One of the problems at the outset in following the type of procedure that's anticipated under this enactment is that it doesn't take into consideration who defends the decision of the board on appeal. At the moment, we're in the position of making the decisions in workman's compensation cases, and the claimant's attorney and the insurer's or employer's attorney represent the respective parties at all levels of the original hearing and the appeals process. As I read this bill very hurriedly, it dawns on me that once the board had made a decision and somebody was unhappy about our decision and it goes to an appeal, the crime victim, perhaps would be represented by an attorney at the appeal level, but who is to be designated to defend the decision of the board? It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, you were in this position and badly overpaid as a district attorney years ago, but that it makes a lot of sense to, as was I,
it's
might
an
add.
Experience, and
it seems to me that the circuit courts of this state, being close to the crime victim, and having ready access, either having gone through a trial or through the office of the district attorney, would have quick knowledge and readily available knowledge of the factual situation and also the developing situation during the process of physical recovery and curing of the victim, and that the district attorney could very well be called upon to defend the decision at any appeal level which the circuit court had made. One problem that we were discussing briefly on the walk over here was that many of the crimes that might be give rise to a claim would not have been tried before the circuit court. It's conceivable that a victim of a crime could be the criminal offense could have been tried in district court or even before the justice peace. But even assuming that, geographically, the situation is close to home to the victim, and the court system is qualified to handle it. We're certainly not ducking the job particularly, but I think it's only fair to this committee to point out some of the differences. Distinction should be also made if a study is made as to what is taking place in the state of Washington under their crime victims law and the state of Oregon. The system of workers' compensation is entirely different in Washington than it is in Oregon. Here we have the independent board, which is a regulatory agency and handles the adjudication of claims, sitting in an impartial position. In Washington, the state fund is they have now a two-way bill, either the state fund or the self-insured, but the responsibility up there is placed in their Department of Labor and Industry, which includes the state fund as, for all practical purposes, a monopoly situation in workers' compensation. So they're in the business of paying out money and deciding claims and all this type of thing, whereas the board doesn't pay anything. We just decide and adjudicate claims. That distinction is something to keep in mind. I talked very briefly with the head of the Department of Labor and Industries in the state of Washington, and I think their experience is the same as been mentioned here before, that the volume of claims filed up to the time last fall, and I talked to Mr. Jacobs up there, was surprisingly small. Compared to what they anticipated. So they're not getting a flood of claims contrary to what they anticipated they would.
Thank you, Mr. O'Leary, who indicated the same thing generally occurred in all other states.
Yes, that's what I understood his testimony. I think the board's position simply stated is that we commend this type of legislation for the consideration of this legislature. We'll do anything within our ability to be of help to this committee in developing any kind of information that we can on it. But we do feel that there are certain considerations that Representative Cromer and Mr. O'Leary particularly have pointed out that should be seriously considered.
Thank you, Keith. I appreciate your appearance and your comments. Are there questions of Mr. Wilson?
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would desire to testify on this measure at this time? If not, I'll declare the hearing closed in House Bill 2060. Don stepped outside to talk to Tony Uteri. I hadn't seen him for a while, but I would commend to the members of the committee that digesting some of this information that we'll be able to. Don will be able to prepare for us and probably have in our books here. And it's understanding, I think, generally that there will be some other proposals in the same nature and perhaps some alternative proposals as far as operations are concerned, but we should wait and consider all of them at one time and then ship whatever determination, whatever bills we determine should receive approval if there are any down the way from me.
Could we get Don to pick up those other three, the copies of those other three bills that were dropped in last time?
I think so.
I think Stan dropped one in, but this is through the workman's comp.
Yeah, I can't remember for sure whether it was that way or the other.
And one of them I know did set up an independent agency, and I'd just like to see them all three.
I would too.
Yeah.
And I'll request that we do that. Now, we have some other bills assigned to the committee, but we aren't in a position to hear them. There'll be no meeting tomorrow. You'll be notified, I guess, at the time of the next meeting. Tuesday? Okay, fine. And we're adjourned.
Representative Kulongoski moves that the committee introduce the bills and object, and if not, so ordered. The committee members will take note that we will not hold the hearing on 2177 today. I think we excuse the people that were here to testify if there's no one else. Bill is 2068. Lee, do you want to kind of lead off your people?
Yes.
Chairman, members of the committee, sitting with me is Mr. Al Lowy, Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. A considerable amount of familiarity with the Administrative Procedures Act, which this bill deals. Chairman, we do have a set of amendments which each of the members of the committee has, and we also, in manually redrafted the bill with these amendments incorporated into it, so you can. If the amendments really do.
Mr. Myers will move the adoption of the bill as amended to bring before the committee for discussion. No objection, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These amendments are proposed as a result of experience with the Department of Justice and others in advising and representing agencies in adopting rules and in contested case proceedings and judicial review before the Court of Appeals. The bill and the amendments are really the result of a kind of an ad hoc committee which consisted of myself, Mr. Lowy, Mr. Hans Lindy from the University of Oregon Law School, Representative Frohmeyer, attended some of our sessions, Mr. Hugh Smith, who was a lawyer in Portland, was one of the spearheads of the Oregon State Bar and former chairman of the Oregon State Bar's Committee on Administrative Law. We also consulted with Judge Schwab on the amendments, he was in support of those amendments. And we've also had a number of discussions with the Secretary of State's office, Mr. Wilson, who's also going to testify today, to try to iron out some of the problems, the operating problems we have in the Administrative Procedures Act. In the area of rulemaking, experience has shown that some problems have arisen because of the notice of rulemaking requirements being tied to the publication of the Secretary of State's Administrative Rule Bulletin. This results in considerable time delays in the adoption of rules and kind of an inflexible procedure which is a consequence, I think, when any time that tends to result, you have agencies trying to find ways to avoid the administrative rules, the Administrative Procedures Act, for going to the procedure which is provided under the Act of adopting temporary rules and then turning around later and holding a hearing and going through the procedures required by the law. We think it's better to try to obviate those kind of time requirements wherever possible. The bill would allow agencies, with the approval of the Attorney General, to establish the character and type of notification that would be most likely to inform the affected and interested person that rule changes were being contemplated. The notice of rule making would still be published in the Secretary of State's bulletin prior to the adoption of the rule. The time schedule of adoption would not be tied to the timetable of the publication of that bulletin. Now, Chairman, Mr. Wilson has suggested that he thinks that that there still should be some time schedule. He has suggested it be shortened from 20 days to 10 days. And it is the intention of the Secretary of State's office, beginning July 1st, to begin coming out on a weekly basis with a bulletin rather than bi-monthly. And we feel that we would agree to that amendment because of this weekly publication. We think that this would be a substantial improvement. The proposed amendments further require that the Attorney General shall compile the procedural rules of all the agencies of state government. This is procedural rules as distinguished from their substantive rules. The idea is to have in one place in the Secretary of State's compilation a compilation of those rules that relate to procedure, so that a lawyer or anyone who wants to make an appearance before an agency can go right to one place to find the information that he needs. Administratively, the Department of Justice and the Secretary of State's office propose to eliminate the requirements of the details of the notice of rulemaking be printed in the Secretary of State's bulletin. The bulletin would list the name of the agency, a brief indication that rulemaking was being contemplated in a particular name, area, and name, address, and telephone number for the agency staff member to contact for information and copies of any proposed rules. It is also contemplated that the compilation of the procedure rules will be renumbered tentatively. Is proposed that they be tied to ORS chapter numbers. It is also contemplated that the administrative rules will be republished in a more usable form, and the bill would require that all agencies' rules must be published in the Secretary of State's compilation. And our idea here is that we will have one publication for all state governments as to where the rules and regulations of the various agencies of state government are located. Hopefully we can get that compilation in a form that's more easy to use than it is now. The Secretary of State's office indicated a good deal of interest in trying to do this. I think we can accomplish it in fairly short order. Judicial review of rules has been moved from the Circuit Court to the Court of Appeals. Now, under present law, contested cases do go to the Court of Appeals, and I think our experience there has demonstrated that it is much faster and less expensive way of obtaining court review of agency action than proceeding to the Circuit Court. The fact of the matter is that in contested cases, we never yet had a case where there was any factual finding, is that right?
No, not really.
Where they've had to appoint a master, there is even less likelihood that you're going to have anything but issues of law come up on a rulemaking proceeding. The usual question is whether the rule is within the power of the agency to adopt under its enabling statute. I think it also, this procedure has the advantage of having a permanent appellate court public opinion, which may be used for agency guidance and is applicable in similar future uses. I think, furthermore, there's just no question about the Court of Appeals, because they see so much more of administrative law cases that they have an expertise in that area that no, there's hardly any circuit courts other than possibly those in Marion County could even have anywhere near the comparable experience. The bill would also remove some provisions in the present law that provide that the governor can provide for exemptions to the Administrative Procedures Act. We feel that it's now time to repeal that provision. That provision was somewhat controversial when it came up. Was that put into the act that when we substantially revised the Administrative Procedures Act in 1971 at my request, because I felt that we had to have some kind of interim procedure to take care of situations that we might not have contemplated when we drafted that major revision in 71. Indeed, we did have one such situation in the Corrections Division. The Corrections Division, for example, for rules of procedure or to apply the contested case procedures and disciplinary proceedings in the Corrections Division would be an almost impossible task. The governor did adopt rules which were subsequently ratified to the last legislature. We don't think that there is now any longer any need for this exemption procedure. Everybody's had 4 years to work under this act, and we think, keeping faith with the legislature, that it's now time to be repealed. The bill now has a new provision which requires that agencies notify persons whose applications for a commercial license have been denied of their right to a hearing. The right, of course, exists under the present law, but there is no requirement that the agency notify the individuals of their right to a hearing. In contested cases, we have made some slight changes to the evidentiary and discovery requirements have been made. I think these are changes that basically make it more understandable to the layman who oftentimes have to work with these rules than the present law. We have made some other changes that are not substantive in nature, but rather a better statement in line with the interpretations the courts have given to the Administrative Act. Administrative Procedures Act. The bill also provides that agency action will be stayed pending judicial review unless the agency demonstrates that public harm will result if the stay is not allowed. In addition, the bill provides that, under present law, it is possible to require the members of boards and commissions who have not conducted a hearing to read the entire transcript and record of the hearing. And frankly, for many of our boards, this is a waste of the board members' time. And for those boards, particularly, we have all citizen members, so to speak. I think it's just an undue burden that serves no useful purpose. The bill amends this requirement, but does still allow the parties to have a right to argue before the full board. Sections 19 through 27 of the bill provides amendments to judicial review of orders of the Public Utility Commissioner will be directed to the Court of Appeals without going through the circuit court. In other words, the Public Utility Commissioner is one office that is exempt from the Administrative Procedures Act because they do have a set statutory procedure that they've had for several years, but we believe that the appeals procedure under the Public Utility Commissioner should be the same as that of the Administrative Procedures Act. We think the same arguments for having direct appeal to the Court of Appeals exist there as they do with any other state agency. Finally, we have done some rearrangement of other sections
primarily to for clarification. I'd be glad to answer any, Mr. Lowry and I would be glad to answer any questions. In fact, I'm probably going to direct most of them to him.
Do you have any additional comments, Bill?
Nothing much. I might make a point that was brought up that the change in the PUC was before the last session. And as a matter of fact, all this is a copy of that bill. That bill did not pass. It was my understanding it was objected to, the railroads that objected to it. It now has the PUC for it, and it's our understanding that most of the regulated utilities think that this is a good idea. The Court of Appeals does. And I might point out one example we have right now is the case of Public Utility Commission rate making, which the same issue is on review simultaneously in Multnomah County and in Benton County, two separate lawsuits going together at the same time, whereas this would mean there'd be only one from the Supreme Court of Appeals.
Dave, may I just ask a question for clarification? I had a bill prepared separately which would provide for including the Public Utility Commission in hearing contested cases. Now, looking at page one or page two of your proposed amendments are integrated. See that section two, subsection three, includes the Public Utility Commissioner exemption.
Yes.
Just as a matter of procedure, would I be best advised? And I don't mean to ask you something that my strategy should be. Would I be best advised to have a separate bill with respect to the deletion of Public Utility Commissioner, or is some other?
I would. The present exemption of the Public Utility Commissioner from contested case procedures is exactly as it is presently. We did not change that.
So that would take a separate bill in.
No, because to put them under contested case procedure. If you'll notice the amendment beginning in section 19 of the section 19, last few pages. Actually, the statutory procedure for the proceedings of the Public Utility Commission are almost identical to contested case procedure. They have, however, always been kept out, along with these others that are kept out, that is employment, PUC, revenue, and the Workman's Comp Board, primarily, traditionally, over the from 71 and in 73, because they already had statutory procedures which in many ways were far more complex than our bare-bones contested case.
Well, this is a matter that I may want to consider then further in a work session on this. Would sections 19 through 27 be necessary if we simply were to strike section 2 sub 3?
No, Representative Frohmeyer, but I couldn't speak for whether or not PUC, as same way as revenue and comp, might not have their own feeling, as that they would prefer to have their own language.
Thank you.
Second's not, if you were to strike the exemption, why then, of course, it would just default immediately control, including the review section.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes?
One of the things that I noticed here, that I take it that your position is that the statute presently requires, as an example, the Public Employee Relations Board to read the transcript.
The basic example is the OLCC. Now, the way this operates is under the present law, in section, and I can show it to you in the bill in a minute, if I just as soon as I get to it. Let's see, 183.460, which you will show up on, look at page 9 of the mock-up bill at the bottom section. The statute now reads that whenever in a contested case, a majority of the officials of the agency who are to render the final order have not heard the case or considered the record, the order, if adverse to the party, but not including the agency, that language, shall not be made until a proposed order, including findings of fact and conclusions of law,
has been served upon the parties and an opportunity has been afforded to each party adversely affected to file exceptions and present arguments to the officials who are to render the decision. This is if they went out, the hearings officer heard it. Then the final clause is where it hurts. Who shall in such case personally consider the whole record or such portions thereof as may be cited by the parties. Now initially it was the assumption that if somebody said, I don't agree with the proposed order, it doesn't, findings of fact don't support, the evidence doesn't support the finding of fact, specifically these particular evidence, or I don't agree with the order because it's an erroneous, the conclusion of law does not follow from the facts found, and here's my oral argument. Okay, that wouldn't go in. They specify, and the members of the agency would look at those portions which were specified.
Specify those portions of the transcript.
Portions of the transcript, or deal with the questions. But the members of our profession are somewhat lazy. And instead of analyzing the objection to the agency's proposed order, they say it doesn't, it's not supported by substantial evidence on the record, and thereupon, therefore, everything has to be transcribed. Those brilliant attorneys' arguments, all of the testimony, self-serving and everything else. And members of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the citizen members in particular, on denials of, in denials of license applications, I get the full transcript mailed all over the state to all three of them prior to the meeting and sit and read their way through it. I have had two cases, particularly out of OLCC, in which the assertion has been made that they didn't do it. For some reason, people don't believe they did it. In both cases, we've had to put in affidavits from the commissioners saying, oh yeah, I personally recollect having read my way all the way through that one. You can also consider if you've got a three-member board, and they're all supposed to do it, you got three copies. We have one that hasn't come to the Court of Appeals in which the hospital siting board, which is about 11 on a certificate of need case to whether an area needed one, they had a hearing, had a hearings officer here and testimony and write a proposed order, and I took about a week. And counsel came in and said, well, your order isn't supported by the entire record. So 11 copies of a one-week hearings officer proceeding have to be transcribed. 1 week, 11 copies, distributed to all 11 members of that board, and they all have to read the entire thing, even though the point and issue is probably very specific. But we can't see any way of how to get the attorneys to specify. It's just easier to say, oh, what the heck, let the state transcribe the whole thing. I never can tell what I might pick up after I think it over.
You've got my thinking very clearly to mind. No, I...
Well, my point would be, I would hope that this would, the practice of this would be, and I'd assume you would too, you've got a hearing before the hearings officer and he puts out the proposed finding and order. You're going to analyze where you feel that's an error. Now, if it's evidentiary, you're going to be able to say, you're going to think it down, aren't you? And you're going to say, now listen, testimony of John Jones and the testimony of Smith and the testimony of so-and-so, you should look at that if you're going on an evidentiary question. If you're not going on an evidentiary question, which probably isn't it true that in 75% of the hearing issues, people are pretty well agreed what the facts are. Usually it's an interpretation of the law. Okay, in so many cases, when the sole issue is a law question, and it isn't a fact question at all, but they'll still just throw in that one basic rule of saying it's not supported by evidence in the record, and the expense and requirement comes there. This doesn't preclude from somebody from saying it isn't supported by evidence in the record and specifically point out that either there is no evidence in here, and if there isn't any evidence in there, you know that on judicial review, there isn't any evidence to support a particular finding of fact that's going to be reversed because there's got to be substantial evidence to support the finding of fact. So you're not precluding drawing the agency's, the board's attention to the specific areas. I'm just trying to preclude the laziness of abusing their time for unnecessary, being drawn to unnecessary areas.
I might add that I think that you should go ask the Supreme Court to change their rules because that's where everyone gets in the habit with the, I think, with the administrative agencies, because on the petition for judicial review, that's all you have to say.
Well, actually, though, as a matter of fact, in ORS 19 on appeal to the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals, there is a provision, and has been for the last 15 years in the law, that you either specify a particular portions of the record, you either specify the entire record and transcript, or you can serve a designated statement of facts. To my knowledge, and I've been hanging around appellate courts for years, no, I've done it once or twice. But most of the time, and you know and I know, it's just laziness. It's not analysis of what my case is about and what I really got to complain about. And what the heck, my client is going to pay for that. If he wants to do it, he's going to pay that $850 bill for the court reporter to transcribe my glorious closing argument, which is of no persuasion.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes. I'd almost ask Representative Frohmeyer to answer that question. It was his suggestion.
I'd be happy to if you'd like me to. But
basically, that isn't going to change anything as it really is, as we have had, as we have the interpretations we've had on evidentiary rulings from the Court of Appeals. Evidence in administrative proceedings is much looser than it is certainly in a criminal or even in a civil action. This would hopefully not allow the problem, would hopefully allow a report from a doctor to come in. Let's take an example of welfare division. Welfare may have a question of entitled to aid to the disabled. All right, there may be objections that the man, they may say, no, he didn't have, they may say, no, we don't find him disabled under the act or entitled to aid. He has a constitutional right and a statutory right to petition for review, to have a hearing on that matter. All right, if you follow strict evidentiary rules and somebody would put it in, you couldn't put the doctor's, a letter from the doctor saying, these are his symptoms and this is my analysis. You're going to have the doctor there and have him cross-examined. It's a heavy burden. It cuts out lawyer nitpicking, I think, and I hope that Representative Frohmeyer
if you yield to me, I'd like to expand on that just for purposes of legislative history on this. The law as it now stands in ORF 183.450 sub 1 was taken from the Model Administrative Procedure Act, which talks about the rules of evidence as applied in equity cases in certain courts of the state. And as Davis has pointed out in his treatise on administrative law, there are no such rules in any state. There are no rules of evidence in equity proceedings. So he termed this the mouthful of being a nonsensical cross-reference to meaninglessness, I think is his phrase. The point of the amendment is simply to allow agencies to do what the United States Supreme Court has done by judicial decision in federal administrative proceedings, and that is to permit hearsay evidence, if it is reliable evidence, to be introduced. Of course, since the primary rationale of the hearsay rule is directed against jury trials, since we're not dealing with a jury but with a trained hearing examiner and with the legal requirements of proof and substantial evidence, it is thought by almost universally that it's inappropriate to insist on a rigid hearsay rule, let alone on non-existent rules of evidence in equity cases. So this language basically conforms to the revised model of the State Administrative Procedure Act, and it
consistent with the revisions in Administrative Procedures Act in Florida and other states which have undertaken major revisions recently.
We're questioning Representative Frohnmeyer because he seems to be the author of the amendment. This particular one, Dave, is that particular amendment, is that the terminology and language used in the other states?
There are two variants, but the language that says relied upon by reasonably prudent persons in the conduct of their serious affairs, that's the basic language that is used to say that as long as it's reliable hearsay, it ought to be admissible without forcing an administrative proceeding into a long technical harangue over the hearsay rule when the rationale for hearsay rule simply isn't present in an administrative proceeding.
Further questions? Go ahead.
The other question I had was that I'm just confused just a little bit. Why did you add 15 and 16 to the bill? I take it that's just is that a recitation of 183-480?
It's a split up of 183-480. If you look, 183-480 has been amended. Starting on page 10, 183-480 is amended to have sections 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay. Now we deleted the balance of sub 2 and the rest of 183-480 because as you look at 183-480 as it exists, it isn't very easy to read, is it? In fact, people stumble through it with great concern. What it does, see, there are two bases of judicial review. Judicial review in a contested case and judicial review of orders in other than contested case. Contested case goes agency to court of appeals. Order other than contested case goes to circuit court. Okay, what's an order in other than a contested case? Simple language it is, the agency didn't make a record. So you can't go to the Court of Appeals because they haven't got any record to work on. Okay, that's all intertwined in the present 183-480. What I did was cut that out of 480. 15 says what you do when you go to the court, when you want judicial review in the Court of Appeals from a contested case and the standard of review. 16 says what you do when you've got an order in other than a contested case and you go to the circuit court. It's for the convenience of lawyers. Further questions?
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Chuck, I guess you're up next. I see that you're representing the Department of Justice, so we'll presume that it's,
I think it's in the Attorney General's handwriting, so I
presume that the Secretary of State will be properly billing. What is the rate, Mr. Johnson?
Ours is 35. I wanted to appear briefly in support of that portion of the amendments dealing with the compilation, publication, distribution of the administrative, the rules of administrative agencies. And to say that we have reviewed the Attorney General's recommendations as amended, and Al will review with you specifically the amendments to his amendments, and it's those amendments that we support, and we believe it will make it possible for us to put together a vastly improved publication which will provide better service, be more readable and more timely, and will dramatically kaleidoscope the time required to have an administrative rule adopted. With that, I'll yield to my friend, Mr. Lally.
Mr. Wilson and I have gone over this. I had not incorporated into the amendments, but these are, let me point out to you what would be added as a result of our discussion.
Do we have copies of these suggested amendments?
Yes. Your little package there has...
We've adopted this.
All right then. I have not because I haven't got them written. It just take me. They're very short.
Okay.
They're very quick, and I think I can explain them to you. If you go to page 3 of the mock-up bill,
in the new material at the bottom of the page. This section deals with what an agency shall do prior to the adoption, amendment, or repeal of a rule. And it says, in essence, that it's going to give notice, A, under the rules that it has adopted for how it will give notice to people, B, in the bulletin referred to in the 183-360, which is the Secretary of State's bulletin. As the amendments as drafted, which you have now, put no prior time prior to adoption of the rule time. It used to be 20 days prior. We took it out, the rationale on that being that the rules the agency had adopted would have to be reasonable, so they specified the time prior. Mr. Wilson and I have discussed it. With a new timetable and a relationship, we still believe it's probably a 10-day period prior in the Secretary of State's bulletin. So I would, what Mr. Wilson suggested, that in the bulletin referred to in 183-360, at least 10 days prior to the effective date and to persons who have requested notice. Let me give you an example of that, and maybe this can possibly point out what the agencies have. Under the present statute, if the Filbert Commission decided to adopt, amend, or repeal a rule today and wanted to, January 29th of 1975, and wanted to do it as fast as possible, there is no way that that rule could, and there was no opposition to it or anything else. And it was just, it was very simple, housekeeping thing that everybody agreed at, nobody had any complaints. But without going the temporary rule route, if they decided to propose such an adoption on January 29th, they could not get it effective earlier than April 11th. And this is how and why that works this way. First step an agency has to take when it wants to adopt, amend, or repeal a rule is publish, under present law, is publish notification in the Secretary of State's bulletin of its intention to do so. All right? Today they wanted to do it. You have to have 10 days lead time to hit the first or 15th bulletin. So you're not going to get in the February 1 bulletin. So your first bulletin you can get into is the February 15 bulletin. So you've got to have your notice of intention to adopt in the Secretary of State's office by February 5th. It'll appear in February 15th bulletin. Now the statute says that rule cannot become effective until 20 days after publication in that bulletin. February 15th, 20 days. The first possible effective date then would be March 7th. But now comes the next hooker in it. The rule cannot be effective, not only not 20 days, but it cannot be effective until 10 days after notice of its adoption has been published in the Secretary of State's bulletin. So it could become effective March 7th, but March 5th has passed. We're too late to get into the March 15 bulletin. So therefore, we've got to put it in by March 20th, the notice that we have adopted our rule in order to get into the April 1 bulletin, and we can't get effective until 10 days after that publication.
Question, why do we need to make these rules effective with such haste?
Not necessarily with such haste. I'm not saying any particular haste, and there's nothing that, let me add, that the effectiveness can be flowed down at any time by any interested person under the present statute. I'm not talking about ones in which the interested public wants to say, hey, slow down, you're moving too dang fast, because that procedure is there. I'm talking about the housekeeping, cleaning item that nobody really cares about. It's just a burdensome situation. Agencies may want to have an effective date in which to change their policy. You know, well, 30 days, 60 days, February, March, 60 days plus is a pretty long time for them to have to wait to act when they get wound up to acting in the first place.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that. My personal philosophy is they ought to have to wait the 2 years until the next legislative session.
Well, I have no objections to that either.
The other point that should be made is that the bulletin is not the sole means of notice under this scheme of things.
the agencies themselves have a duty to notify their users, their clientele, as soon as they intend to adopt the rule and file it with our office. The 10-day notice that we're talking about is in the bulletin itself. Most of the affected parties will have received the notice from the agency before anyone receives the bulletin. The 10-day after receipt of the bulletin is simply a fail-safe mechanism so that anybody who wants to subscribe will know that when they get the bulletin, they better look because they got 10 days. But the affected parties will, in most cases, have their notices in advance that day.
Okay, moving on then.
Just a second.
Yeah.
I think you've got to recognize there are a lot of situations that do require some haste in getting those rules put out, and I wouldn't describe them as emergency situations. They are situations in which the agency wants to hold hearings. And a lot of times I've seen it where the agency actually did hold hearings, but they had to go do it again because of these time lags created. And the best example I can think of is the Secretary of State had to adopt a number of sets of regulations related to campaign financing law. If we had to wait the whole time on those rules,
let me again point out that, as Mr. Wilson pointed out, there's a provision which has existed and still is retained in the law in the Administrative Procedure Act. Any person who wants to know what an agency is going to do can, under the present Administrative Procedure Act, write to the agency and say, you put me on a mailing list and I receive individually notice of every adoption, amendment, or repeal of any rule that you were going to do. If you're a barber and you want to know it, you write in, and you're going to get it personally in the mail. You don't have to follow the Secretary of State's bulletin. This was put in 73. To my knowledge, I don't think it's been taken advantage of if very, very rarely. It's unfortunate, but the agency faced this problem all the time. How paternalistic did they get to go out and grab you by the throat and say, look, we're going to change it, let's have your input? People don't show up.
But the Secretary of State's bulletin would be the only universal publication that would give us, say, as members of the Legislative Assembly, place us on notice.
Of everything that every agency is doing. But if you have the universal, a particular either attorney for a particular industry or a particular profession can get on the mailing list. All right, the next suggestion of Mr. Wilson.
Could you do this for us, Al?
Yeah.
Could you provide us with a summary before our work session on the bill that would show, or Tuck, one or the other of you, that would show the changes in the time frames between present and your suggested...
I'd be glad to do that. When's your work session, Mr. Wilson?
We haven't looked at the bill sometime around June 15th.
Oh, that's fine. All right. Okay. The next area off, page 6. As I had drafted about the middle of the page, the new material amending 183.360. As I had drafted it, I had removed the requirement to index 183.360 sub 1. The Secretary of State shall compile, and I had deleted index. Mr. Wilson said that he would prefer to have it in there, and it was certainly the Secretary of State's interest. Also, I had deleted in the last sentence in paragraph 1 of section 183.360 that the Secretary of State may make such compilations of other material published in the bulletin as he deems desirable. Mr. Wilson preferred to have that retained, and so that was proposed there. On the top of 6 continued is new language relating to what the bulletin shall contain. I think we're in accord on it, although I had indicated that in sub B that all that would be necessary relating to a regulations that had been adopted would be a brief description. As the statute now stands, the Secretary of State has the option of either publishing an entire rule as adopted or a description of saying where you can get a copy of it. Of course, to require to publish the entire rule would be DEQ and some of the others. It just make it too massive. Now, that's publication in the bulletin. That is as distinguished from inserting it into the compilation.
Bob?
Yeah, I don't know if this applies, but I remember the adoption of uniform billing codes. Was that promulgated under these provisions?
Probably was.
And how about the safety provisions in Senate Bill 44? That was probably.
Yeah, that was the OSHA occupational self. Yeah, that was that.
Yeah, well, I get a lot of criticism that people can't even find where the rules are. They can't find out what the law is, and it's already in effect. So now we're taking it away from what the Secretary of State even.
No. What we're suggesting here is that the Secretary of State will retain the discretion to publish the entire text in the bulletin. The compilation will always have the entire text, but that may follow by several weeks the bulletin. But we want to retain that flexibility where we think that it's a matter of public interest that we can include the text in the bulletin. We want to retain that authority.
Chairman, what we're contemplating is that all the finally adopted rules will be in this compilation. Probably for some of these agencies like DEQ and the intensity regulations, would be a separate volume for you. Instead of DEQ publishing anything, if you publish through the Secretary of State's office and maybe volume one of the administrative regulations, so you always know you can go to the Secretary of State and find out.
That's the word you're talking about.
I think the practical effect is the other agencies are put publishing separately. So merely contact the Secretary of State and publish out extra copies for the people.
Now there's sometimes I've seen where in the adoption of the administrative rule they'll refer to a federal booklet on truck safety or and adopt that in total by a reference. Is that right?
Contrary to Oregon law, it was held unconstitutional in Hillman versus North Wasco PUD in 1959.
Well, I've got complaints about that. They can't get the booklet.
If they do, they
I think it was OSHA standards that happened to be some sort of truck.
They can incorporate. Yeah, this I've been aware of this. They can incorporate certain standards. It's a bad practice. We certainly always discourage it if they bother to consult us. If they don't bother to consult us, why? And they make their policy decisions. We don't. If that's the way they want to go.
This is a matter of information. I presume you have all rules compiled in the Secretary of State's office now.
All rules are filed in the Secretary of State's office, but not all rules are published by the Secretary of State.
Okay. Just to give a horseback shot in comparing the rules which you have filed in the Secretary of State's office with our ORS volume, tell me about the volume of material.
You mean in terms of feet?
Yes, feet.
The feet that appear in our compilation is about 2 feet. 2.5 feet.
The type's a lot bigger. Your ORS type is awfully small.
Wait, that compilation
doesn't include DEQ. I was talking about the ones that we did.
Does include DEQ higher end?
And bind them differently. We're going to bind them so that they're more useful in smaller binders
presently what is compiled, I don't know if you've seen it, it's two binders, both about that size. It's reproduced on one side, I think one side or two sides of the page. And I think it's only reproduced on one side of the page. And it is very difficult, no question about it, very difficult to get into. I mean, there's just no question about it. It's bulky and unwieldy to work with.
Excellent book, yeah.
when you make those, is that the only, that isn't the only method of distribution? I mean, if
no.
I have...
No, the agencies themselves make distribution. And if you...
The agency, instead of publishing their own edition, they have their rules to publish, they have a Secretary of State's binder, and you do regulations that you buy in one of this, you buy in five of
Is there any means of subscription to all regulations?
Yes. The present rate for subscribing was established by the General Services Division in 1959. And if you hurry, you can get in on this bargain. By paying us $50, you'll receive a lifetime subscription to all the bulletins and an update on the compilation. That is truly a bargain. We're hoping that this session of the legislature will change that practice and let the Secretary of State establish the rate to be charged for the service so that we can return to the general fund some reasonable approximation of its cost.
Chuck, does that price give you the existing value?
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh, right. It's a bargain. I'd rush.
Can you get it in just the subject matter that you're interested in?
Yes, you can.
Subscription for
by subscription? No, not yet. That's the service that's on the drawing board. We hope to have that available. At the present time, if you write to us, we have copies available instantly after the filing for the cost of copying. Or if you wait until it's been printed, it's available at a reduced cost, which is essentially our printing cost.
Is this question being considered by Ways and Means?
Yes, Ways and Means has approved an increase in our staffing in anticipation of our increased workload in upgrading the ACA.
Is it universally held by the committee that service such as approved service that you touch speaks up by the Secretary of State is a good thing? I think it would be.
Chairman,
is there any objection to asking our council to send a note to Ways and Means suggesting that they give favorable consideration to that? Any objection? So ordered.
Stan?
Presently in the ORS statute, we have a method of getting into any topic, any subject matter. If this bill passes and we have a central clearinghouse for all the rules, will there be a similar type of index so that I can go to the rules, look in an index, find a topic matter, and find where in the rules I find those kinds of topics?
You may have noted from the Attorney General's remarks that the Secretary of State, under his rulemaking authority, has some discretion in the way we actually carry out legislative intent, and it is our intention to change the reference system, the indexing system, and we hope to be able to do it so that we will make reference to ORS chapters, so that the rule, the number on the rule will correspond to the number on the ORS chapter that it elaborates.
Beyond that, let's say that I'm an attorney and I've got a client and I'm trying to get into the rules for that client on a topic matter. Will it do other than just simply refer to an ORS? Will there be a way to...
We'll have to develop an index, which we presently don't have. That's what we understand the problem. We need a more sophisticated index. We hope to do that.
Further questions? If not, thanks a lot. We'll probably schedule a... you can provide us with a copy of those amendments.
You already have.
Okay, we'll probably schedule a Tuck's amendment.
I have an original. Maybe I can get to council.
Yeah.
I can incorporate Chuck's proposed amendments in these. If you,
they're just a couple of them. They're not
yes,
long.
Your proposed amendments really relate to the administration. Is there any objection to just trying to have council work and incorporate these, and we'll deal with it as amended at least at this point? Will you do that, Don? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on 2068? Okay, that concludes our hearing. We'll try and have a work session, say, in a couple weeks.
Are you going to let us know?
We'd like to, if we can help it, not at this point. Now, do you have a bill you want to introduce, Dave, on the same subject?
Yeah, but it'll be separate, and I wouldn't want a torpedo where I think there's some extremely good amendment to the APA if the PUC will develop this controversial item, so I want to put that in a separate bill.
Please. Yours is only going to relate to the PUC?
That's right, and we'll simply strike the existing exemption of the PUC from the contested state procedure of the APA.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm thinking.
New guy in our office, he just over crying.
That I don't know if we can do that.
Okay, Dawn, if you can get it in gross, let's do it. Okay, we'll go to 2074. Mr. Bird and let's have a good lawyer here. I can't read his writing.
Gavick.
Okay. Darren Gavick. Thank you. We'll turn the show over to you, gentlemen.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I might summarize what the present law
I'll
does.
Tell you, if you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Bird, B-I-R-D, Michael Bird. Chairman, the committee, the present law, as I understand it, the way it's written, is permits a person who has a judgment, it's all dealing with after judgment proceedings. The present, the person who has a judgment against another person, can, after he asks the clerk for a writ of execution and has the execution served and returned nil, no found, then he can move in the court for an order requiring the debtor to appear at a certain time and place in person. It requires an affidavit by the judgment creditor or his attorney to the effect that he believes there is property available for execution when application to the judgment. The order must be served on the debtor by the sheriff or by someone else who's authorized to serve process, and the cost of the service is added to the judgment itself. Of course, after the orders served, the creditor or his attorney will appear, and assuming the debtor does not want to risk contempt of court, he will appear also, and he is required to answer under oath any questions that the judgment creditor or his attorney may have regarding property or rights in property. The amendment, as we've prepared it, would eliminate the necessity of going through the often strictly futile process of obtaining a writ of execution, having it served just in order to have it returned nil, and adding the cost of the sheriff's service fees to the judgment itself. It would permit, in lieu of this execution, a notice of demand to pay the judgment within 10 days. In other words, the creditor or his attorney would mail a notice to the debtor saying, pay this judgment within 10 days, and it could be mailed, the service can be mailed by mail with a return receipt. And once the 10 days has expired, the creditor could, if it had not been paid, appear before the court, present the receipt showing that the debtor had received the notice, and obtain an order requiring him to appear, the debtor to appear in person and answer questions. There would be the elimination of the sheriff's service fee. There would also be the elimination of going this extra step to obtain a writ of execution. There's also, in our amendment, no requirement for this affidavit stating that the creditor believes there is property, because in most cases the reason for the hearing is because you don't know whether he has any property. So why have to fill out a phony affidavit saying you do believe it? Obviously, it's a fishing expedition to begin with. There's another alternative set forth in the amendment, which is strictly voluntary on both the debtor and the creditor's part. It would allow, in lieu of an actual face-to-face meeting, it would allow the creditor to send written interrogatories to the debtor. And the interrogatories would notify the debtor that he's to answer them under oath, and they would be directed to questions of whether the debtor has property available for application of the judgment. This would, as I say, be voluntary, and if the debtor chose to ignore them, the creditor would be forced to go into court with his motion for a definite time and place. There's also we feel this would benefit the debtor in that if he does wish to comply with the interrogatories, he doesn't have to take off work, he doesn't have to drive downtown to the courthouse, he can fill them out at his leisure. If the judgment debtor is ordered by the court to appear at a certain time and place, we've included a sort of a relief valve in subsection 2 of the amendment to 23710, which simply states that the judgment debtor can request of the court an excuse from appearing at the time and location indicated in the order, or he can ask that it be done at some other time. And we didn't attempt to set forth any specific reasons that the debtor would have, but just made it in general language. Upon motion seasonably made and upon notice and for good cause shown, request of the court. And I think that's pretty important, that the debtor be able to have some relief from the burden of appearing, especially in the event he might lose his job if he had to take off or something like that. That pretty well summarizes the changes. Oh, there's one other one about, we did change the present law to 20, he can't be required to appear in, at a place more than 20 miles from his residence. We felt that was an unrealistic distance these days. We moved it up to 100 miles, but we also provided that if he's required to appear more than 100 miles away, the creditor would have to pay him mileage fees, mileage and witness fees that provided in chapter 44 for witnesses. If you have any questions, I'd be glad.
Do you have additional comments, sir? Well, I think Mike's covered it pretty well. I might comment more philosophically than anything else. I've been on the Oregon State Bar of Debtor Creditors Rights now for 2-3 year terms and sort of watch people come and go, and I find more creditor attorneys produce more debtor-oriented bills and vice versa. This one, we hope, it strikes a happy medium because we seem to be fairly well balanced. We are quite interested in having service by mail. We think that that's very important. We think that tacking on $7.50 every time you turn around and then wondering not whether or not the local sheriff is zapping you or not, and when you get an NS or not found return, and you go and try and explain this to your client, and you got a problem, a public relations problem. The 100-mile residence probably goes to show more than anything else the lack of understanding on the part of an attorney's bar committee on the workings of the legislature. We took what the existing statute was and decided to monkey around with it as little as possible because we were afraid it wouldn't get through. We wanted to get through. We took 20 miles and we said, gee, that sounds like a good day's ride on horseback when this was all first passed. And now with the lower speed limit, I suppose that 100 miles is a good day's drive. That's about how we got with that figure. It's totally arbitrary on it. We don't want to be burdensome on either the creditor or the debtor. So if you'll notice that if the debtor shows up, and about 50% of the time the debtor does not show up for a debtor's exam, if he shows up and he's more than 100 miles, he is entitled to some witness fees. Now, being a smart creditor's attorney, somebody's going to have to have that money that you just paid him applied on your judgment. It's better than nothing. Some court is going to rule one way and some another. This whole thing originated from listening to the horror stories of attorneys around the state practicing in different courts, and particularly in my county, coming up with entirely different interpretations of the statute than we could read in the statute. We're trying to get a little bit more sensibility, a little bit more up to date, and make it a little bit more flexible, and at the same time give the debtor an opportunity to say, hey, it's inconvenient for me for this reason or that reason or the other reason to appear at the specific time and the specific place you want, but I'll be happy to make disclosure to you at some other time or some other place. That shouldn't cause a hardship to anybody. The written interrogatories were designed just exactly as Mike said. Why do we take up all this court time? It's really simple. You have the questions that you want to ask as the attorney, and you know what they are before you've ever walked over there. I've got a canned set of forms. And you just put those things in a copy machine and shoot them out, and you get the answers. And you either have property or you don't have property. You either have a judgment which is uncollectible or partially collectible or is totally collectible, but now you know, and then you can do what you're going to do as a creditor. From the debtor's point of view, he can pick the time, he can pick the place, he can pick who he consults on how to answer the question, but there isn't any question as to what the question was, and there isn't any question what the answer was. And with the advent of a copy machine, it's very easy to have those in a format which is going to make it really pretty easy for the debtor and creditor alike to have a line of communication open to them, which has heretofore been effectively closed. There are some unanswered questions in the bill. One is, what happens if you serve the debtor by mail and the letter doesn't come back, but Uncle Sam has told another one of Uncle Sam's things, the return receipt doesn't come back either, so you don't know whether or not he got it. We question whether or not you would be able to be entitled to an order of contempt, but we think that's going to be judicial determination. It becomes a matter of proof, and that return receipt is some evidence. And that would include the only other remarks I have. Ted?
We have a rule on the committee, and I think we have an opportunity to exercise it, that whenever we have a new statute, we have to repeal an old one. And the question I have is that...
You're Warren, Mr. Kuhn,
I found one to repeal.
No, I'm just wondering why that in HB 2074 that you have a restraining order on the encumbering or disposing of any property, and you didn't do anything to 23730, which appears to be a statute that says restraining disposal of property at the time of allowing the order referred described in order 23710 or at any time thereafter, pending the preceding the court or judge may make an order restraining the judgment debtor from selling, transferring, or in any manner disposing of any of the property liable to execution pending the proceeding.
Do you want a very smooth, polished answer, neighbor?
Yeah.
Or do you want the real honest right. truth?
Yeah.
What, the only thing,
real honest truth is because we didn't think of it.
We really didn't think of it.
Oh, okay.
Now, if you're deciding as to which to do, I'd have a recommendation. That is, leave that existing statute alone because it applies more than the debtor exam. It provides for the next step down the highway, which is the contempt when the debtor doesn't show up. And it also applies after he doesn't show up to find out whether or not he's in contempt when the sheriff goes out to physically grab him for disobedience to court's order and not showing up at the debtor's exam, not showing up at the contempt hearing. And then he is literally placed under arrest and amount of security deposit. That order can be encompassed under that statute that you just read for all three of those proceedings. Under this one, it would probably, in most counties, be interpreted to be restricted only to the debtor's exam.
Yes, that's what my concern, because the way it's written, I would take it that someone would argue that if you didn't ask for the restraining order at the time you asked for the order having the debtor's exam, that you have waived any attempt to have the debtor restrained from encumbering the property.
I think only in district court Lane County would you get that ruling.
So you could, your position would be that online
only out of two of the four judges, excuse me.
And you're asking for another position,
I just to clarify, how about three?
On line 25 of the bill,
we agreed to create two and designate judges.
Yeah, there they are.
I would leave it.
David and I
smile.
Clean this committee ad.
After the word claim,
I'm sorry, line what?
25 on the
okay.
second page. Would be your position then that you would just soon have that following sentence stricken from the bill?
Such yeah, so I think that there's probably, such order may be restraining and enjoying. Representing quite both debtors and creditors, I suppose it all depends on whose ox is getting gored. I question the constitutionality of that statute, of that particular portion, because what about property which is exempt from execution? Are you going to enjoin and restrain him for that, or by enjoining and restraining him from disposing of that, aren't you completely and totally defeating his other statutory rights, thereby depriving him of due process, i.e. to take his exempt wages, go down to the grocery store, and buy some bread while he's waiting for the court to have time to listen to it. And so, yes, I'd consent to that insofar as it's within my power to.
I think it's redundant, but,
I would make a motion at this time that's part of it.
Kukulandoski moves that we delete it on line 25.
Starting the word such.
Going through line 28, ending with the word court. Any objection? So ordered.
Starting slow, and I didn't. Is it on page 3?
On page 2 of the bill,
page 2.
Line 25, beginning with the word such,
mm-hmm.
going through line 2, line 28, ending with the word court. Is there any problem with that?
Did the committee consider making the failure to answer the interrogatory to the ground for obtaining the hearing?
We considered it.
It would be unnecessary.
You,
under existing law and what we're proposing, the judgment creditor has, as a matter of right, an opportunity to find out what the judgment debtor has or that he doesn't have anything, so that he can decide what to do with his other piece of paper that now tells him that he's got money owed to him. The judgment creditor has the alternative as to asking for a personal appearance of the judgment debtor or a written interrogatory. Presumably he could ask both, but I think that some client is going to question some attorney on charging him for both those when they're both designed to produce and presumably would produce the same information. I don't see any prerequisite type thing, because in some cases a judgment's a judgment, whether it's a $100 judgment for some doctor bill or a $100,000 judgment for some fairly large complex business transaction.
Hardy, let me interrupt you for one moment. Do you have a question, Dave?
Yeah, it's a very brief one. What is the source of this? Is this written out of whole cloth, or does this come from another state statute or a model act of some kind?
This is written out of whole cloth, being thrashed over and revised through some, I think, 8 or 10 separate drafts that Mike Bird and Mike Kaloran and Grant passed. Kept taking the committee's input and putting it down on paper and coming back and having the committee change their mind or chop up or whatever.
We did look at the Russian state.
Was it in any way related with respect, for example, to the service of interrogatories as a substitute for personal appearance or anything of that nature?
No.
That part of it was kind of, I think, in the Child Custody, the Uniform Child Custody Act, I think, has a provision in it for service by mail, and some of the federal statutes permit it. And we just thought it was
I think it's ingenious. I was just curious to know where it came from. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do either of you gentlemen, Ted or David, have any objection unless we find some other testimony passing this bill out today?
I'm going to defer. I have no problem if Mr. Myers gets his concern.
We're going to take care of his concern, but you guys needed to leave.
Okay.
Hardy, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but these boys need to get away.
You obtain your judgment. You decide under this new section to file instead of interrogatory. Let's suppose you get another one. The judge is now worried. In order to get a hearing, still requires, as I understand, a motion supported by either return of service on unsatisfied execution, or might not have an additional ground that simply, showing that interrogatories have been served and not answered as a ground for a hearing.
Yes, you're missing the step, because let's assume that you're my client and somebody else owes you money and I've gotten a judgment on your behalf and Charlie hasn't paid. And so you come to me and say, hey, I paid my bill and where's my money? And I say, well, Charlie still has it, I think. Well, why don't you find out? Son of a gun, I'll have a debtor's exam right away. Now, I make a choice. I either bring him in personally, or I serve the interrogatory. Now, because I'm lazy and because I've got a good copy machine, I'm probably going to choose the copy machine route, which means the interrogatory, put the case name on, and I can dictate a letter, and my secretary can put that out, and I'm going to be charging you $10 or $15 for essentially $4 worth of work. And I'm going to mail that to him, return receipt requested. If I don't get answers back, and I do get that receipt back, I'm going to bring that debtor in on your behalf to show cause why he should not be held in contempt of court for his failure to answer those written interrogatories.
Well, I've got a problem. The authority to,
you just hit the problem. And you hit one other problem, too, that you may or may not be aware of, and that is that we don't have as a prerequisite for the debtor's exam, for the written interrogatories, the NS return of the demand to pay a judgment.
Well,
I'm not saying we should have.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that if, but you've also highlighted a problem. I don't know that the quarry was in the barrels of this bill for the court to hold the debtor in contempt for failing to execute.
We don't know either.
There isn't.
I don't think
we don't know either.
There isn't.
Why shouldn't there be?
It's going to be tried.
Well, I mean, why not spell that out as a sanction for failure to answer a debtor?
Sure, it may not get through the legislature, frankly.
Well, I could answer that.
Come back to my original point. You serve the interrogatories, you get no answer. You're relying now on a power of the court to hold the non-responding debtor in contempt as your way of getting him into court. In the wake of the failure to answer.
Wake of the non-failure. Now, the only reason why our judicial system works is because people do generally that which they're supposed to do. If the guy gets arrested for a traffic violation and he comes in, the judge says, you'll pay $10, he pays the $10. I mean, the judge doesn't go, do it. And it's the same, and that's where society works, fortunately. We're hopeful. We don't have the experience of this, that the interrogatories will work so many more times than not that we're not going to be terribly concerned about those instances where it does not work. We'll have to do something else instead. I'm not sure that I'm answering your question.
Yeah, you are. Well, I just wanted to be sure that there was a deliberate reason, really two things, why there was no sanction provided with respect to non-response. And in the absence of a sanction, why the simple failure to respond wasn't made an express ground for getting an order to compel him to come into a hearing. Instead of, as this would work, you serve the interrogatories, you get no answer. Then into this, you've still got to file a motion with return of service of an unsatisfied execution, or then serve a notice of demand to pay the judgment in order to get the order. The mere failure to respond to the interrogatories, which is really trying to look at the same information that you're going into the hearing to get, is not made a ground for the hearing. And that's my only point of that.
One of the questions, of course, you can build into your interrogatories is, will you pay this judgment when? That would be the two questions. And that could be your written demand to pay the judgment. Upon the 10 days being passed, you come in under the subsection 1 to get your personal occurrence. But, or you would have a separate notice of demand to pay judgment under the first.
Well, if the demand to pay judgment is something that the demand to pay judgment is something that you want to oblige to serve any time before you get a hearing.
Either that or an execution.
Well, then
it's an alternative.
My point's invalid.
We did talk though about the possibility of making it a consent. Calling him in for contempt for failure to answer the interrogatories, and he was rejected by the committee because it is a voluntary thing, and when you've got service by mail, there's always a possibility that he didn't get them, and there's no point in putting him on the spot, possible contempt, just because he didn't get a copy of the interrogatory.
That would be a defense to contempt. We also have it.
Well,
we just weren't convinced that failure to respond to interrogatories is contemptuous conduct within the meaning of the contempt statute or our common law concept of what contempt is. And I don't think that anybody on the committee, with myself as a possible exception, is willing to experiment to find out, experiment legislatively to find out.
In order for it to be, you would almost have to incorporate the interrogatories into an order.
Right.
Which would be rather cumbersome.
Yeah. Because we now have some of that procedure in other areas of discovery, taking into written interrogatories upon a deposition, written deposition, and it's very cumbersome. And we, somebody, I'm sure, sometime, someplace, will try to enforce the return of the interrogatories by contempt proceedings. And a court's going to say, yes, that is, or no, that isn't. We believe they'll probably say, no, it isn't. But
you know, I'm not the judge.
It may work well enough that, or it may not work well enough, but another 2 years we'll be back asking for the failure to answer the interrogatory to have some sort of a possible penalty provision, but at this point we felt it was best just to use it as a voluntary method.
Hardy, does that solve your problem if you wish to have an amendment of any sort? The chair will, I don't want to really rule Bob, but we'll state the position of the chair that the committee rules, the House rules, and Mason's states that if one member of this committee objects to the final consideration of the bill before the committee on its day of first hearing, that one objection is sufficient to require that that bill be held over until another meeting of the committee. See that our other people are aware of that. Is that a fair way to conduct things, I think? I would like to move this bill out if there's no objection today. That will give us a bit of a guideline. So if any one person objects, when we have others that are absent, or if they feel that we should have more testimony, now is there a motion to move this bill out?
So.
Representative Stultz moves the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. The clerk will take note that those present were voting aye. We thank you, gentlemen. You're the first representative so far that has gotten your bill out immediately.
Thank you for the opportunity. We've got 9 more that went through.
We trust that the bill is well drafted.
We believe it is. We've worked awfully hard on that. Thank you.
Hardy, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes.
Okay. Lieutenant Myers is designated to carry the bill. Yes, it's the rule of the chair, but I was taking the position that I had that I was encompassing all other rules. Let's say it's a policy of the chair. I suppose that's better than a rule. I think that's a fair policy.
There may be times when you want to withdraw from that policy.
Oh, that applies only to the first hearing of the bill.
22-23.
Mr. Hart? 22-23.
My name is Harold C. Hart. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm currently the director of the juvenile court. Prior to that time, I was the administrator of the Courts Process Division for Multnomah County. Prior to that time, for 10 years, was in the District Attorney's Office. 7 years of that was in the Domestic Relations Department of that office. Prior to that time, 7 years in the private practice of law. And I'm the secretary of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Family and Juvenile Law. House Bill 2223 makes one addition to the provisions which the court may include in a decree for the dissolution or annulment of the marriage or for separation from bed and board. And quite simply, that's on page 4 at line 9 of the proposed legislation, which merely adds the provision for a restraining order, which would prohibit and restrain a party from in any manner molesting or interfering with another or with a minor child or children of the marriage. Present situation with regard to interspousal violence, not only in this state but nationally, is really quite severe, and those of us who have toiled daily in the vineyards of other people's marital mistakes, I think, can attest to that. Nationally, roughly 25-30% of all homicides fall within this particular category. In Oregon, it's 29.7%. of homicides fall within marriage situations, in addition to that, another 17% fall within sweethearts, acquaintances, and lovers. And I have for you a kind of a factual background stating the statistical situation with regard to the climate in which our committee approached this particular problem. The present situation with regard to the law in dealing with this problem is that we have an anomalous situation where, during the pendency of the dissolution of marriage, the court has the authority to restrain the parties from annoying or molesting or harassing each other, and then that, based upon fact and law, then that situation terminates upon the entry of the decree. The situation, however, often continues long past the decree, and the court then, the restraining order terminates with the entry of the decree, and there's no legal lever, no legal procedure for handling these things, absent going through the criminal law. And those of us who have been in the district attorney's office and who've dealt daily with the law enforcement people know very well that the reluctance of the police, first of all, to involve themselves in what they call family disturbances or family beef, secondly, to charge in these situations, even where they feel personally that they ought to involve themselves, and thirdly, they know of the high degree of washout on the charging deputy district attorney's desk with regard to these kinds of complaints. So that even if it does make itself to district attorney's office, the chances of the charge ever being put is very, very small. Consequently, the present state of the law leaves the victims of this type of a situation with either going to the criminal law or doing nothing. And the net result is that nothing usually occurs in these types of situations. In addition to that, we have a very technical, sophisticated, and I'm not quite so sure that I understand method of peace bonds, which is rarely, if ever, utilized in this particular area. What we probably not. I think that has been abolished. Oh, thank you. All right. Historically, I guess those things had been used, but very rarely, even when we had
very reluctantly by district attorney.
Yes. That was the climate and the present situation of the law with regard to dealing with the problem of post-decree violence between former spouses. What we propose to do by this legislation is to add one more legal canon to the arsenal of things that we can do when these situations arise. If the police view that family beefs or family disturbances are in truth and in fact domestic relations matters, then that in fact is what we're making them, domestic relations matters, and we're giving the court the additional authority to deal with the violation of the restraining order in a contempt forum. We think also that the responsiveness would be faster, more appropriate, since the court has already, in many cases, already dealt with the factual issues by virtue of a restraining order during the pendency of the case, and is familiar with the particular situation, and more knowledgeable with how to handle it. I guess, in essence, what this is a logical extension of the status quo with regard to restraining orders and domestic relations proceedings. And that's what we're asking to do by this legislation.
Well, I'm concerned about the provision in respect to the minor children, and I think any of us who've had any substantial amount of practice in domestic relations who realize that children are generally a tool in connection with these passes between husband and wife or former husband and former wife, and yet the natural parent has a right of visitation.
Unless that's been exempted. It would come up in this guise, an incest situation, a battered child type of situation, a situation where the conduct... party may be reluctant to prosecute the incest, may be reluctant to get into the battered child situation with so far as the juvenile court, but it may came out during the testimony of the dissolution that this is the condition of that situation, and I could see very, very well the court wanting to enter a restraining order between parent and child in that type of a situation.
in the situation that you've alluded to, is how would a restraining order between former spouses affect a non-custodial parent's opportunity to exercise his visitation rights and privileges. My suggestion would be to handle it much as we're handling it here, and that is where visitation for World War II is still continuing between the former spouses, but visitation takes place at some place other than in the home of the custodial parent. For instance, we arranged through the Family Consultant's Office and Conciliation Services to work out visitation schedules in order to guarantee and ensure the non-custodial parent's right exercise of his right of visitation, but without contacting, communicating, harassing, annoying the custodial parent with the war situation that goes on between them.
The jurisdictions that have the facilities for doing that, however, are rather limited.
The court can order this, and our courts do.
Yeah, I know the court can order it, but who's going to make the arrangements in most jurisdictions? There just isn't anyone to do it.
In the absence, then, I suppose it what you're really speaking to is the absence of innovation or imagination on behalf of your court. The problem, I think, is far more likely to occur where the non-custodial parent uses the visitation ploy as a gambit to come in and beat up on the ex-wife. And I see that far more frequently than the other. And the restraining order would resolve, I think, that situation.
What I've seen on the other side of that coin during Senate Leidy proceedings where there's a restraining order is the wife will invite the guy back until something goes wrong, and then she'll scream violation of the order. And I can see that arising here in the nation of the divorce.
Representative, isn't that a matter of proof?
But it doesn't make the guy feel any better when he's fighting the court. In fact, he has an opportunity to prove that he didn't do it.
I don't say that this is going to be the panacea or the cure-all for all of it. I just say it's one small step in a journey of maybe 10,000 miles relating to the larger problem of interspousal and former spousal violence, which is something that those of us in the field have to deal with almost daily and are most frustrated insofar as our inability to deal with it. The absence of the law and this kind of a law is part of the problem.
Isn't this just another way of getting a termination of a parental right?
No.
It isn't?
No.
Getting on to end that way?
No. A termination of parental rights are provided for specifically by statute under ORS 419.
I know the procedure for it, but the effect of it, wouldn't it be the same as you entered in the final decree that you entered a restraining order against the husband from interfering or molesting with the children? That effectively what you've done is you terminated a parental right on it.
Yeah. Effectively what you've done is to have prevented or prohibited at that time that parent's opportunity to contact and communicate with the child. That should be done for cause. But that is not a termination. That is not a termination. What? Yes, absolutely. Sure. Yes, that is a permanent. That's what's known as permanent commitment. But the other is not. It is subject to modification at any subsequent time.
I understand what you said earlier, not just now, but one of your earlier comments about the use of the restraining order, that you contemplate that you could have visitation rights if you were the
absolutely
parent, and at the same time have a restraining order
between the parents.
But how about you surely couldn't have visitation rights and a restraining order restraining you from in any manner molesting or interfering with the minor children of marriage?
No, that would be antithetical to visitation. That's correct.
Okay.
I think the number of cases involving a restraining order between parents and children would be minimal in comparison to the restraining orders that might be permitted between former spouses. I think in the total run of domestic relations cases, a total amount of restraining orders would also be a minority situation.
No, I don't think I'm going to see a
you just deny it as a provision of the decree. Yeah.
Is it an affirmative statement?
Yes. Yes. He's prohibited from exercising any visitation rights, or his visitation rights are denied. Yes.
With such an order now, would that be enforceable under show cause
for
a family
the
relationship
is
just
in
the same place?
Yes. What? No.
In other words, if the decree states there's no visitation, the order to pay child support and no visitation, so visiting.
Yeah, I think that would be in violation of a decree. It would be an indirect contempt. It would be punishable under Chapter 1, I think, of ORS, and Chapter 30. I think you could punish that as an indirect violation of a specific provision of the decree, commanding or prohibiting you from doing an act.
It wouldn't, though, reach medium life.
It would not at all. And that's the matter of primary concern, and really the thrust of this proposal. It would, however, cover the situations that have been alluded to with regard to those cases in which it was inappropriate for the non-custodial parent to have anything to do with the child.
Did you file
it? Yes, it was done under my direction. Thank you.
You know where I'm telling the truth. What's the certification of the decrees that are the visitation of plenty of denied?
Very rare. Very rare. But it happens in the types of cases that I've described. The beating, battering father, the incestuous relationship. I've seen it in stepfather situations, which are really more style than substance.
Isn't the answer to that problem a direct approach? Just deny the visitation rather than a restraining order.
Yes, I think the court would probably. In addition to that, I really see the restraining order more applicable in the spouse-to-spouse relationship than I do the parent-child.
Further questions? Not, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Art. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on 2223? Now that concludes our agenda, does it not, Don? Any further business to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned until the